Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Game Junk Podcast for January 2015. This is episode number 22, and my name is Sean.
My name is Andrew.
And coming up on this month's episode, we've got something a little different. We're going to be talking about some news and some games we've played, but we're also going to be talking about the launch of Citizens of Earth, which obviously we've talked about on the show before. But we're going to talk kind of about the development process and try to let you, the listeners, in on the good stuff. So,
oh, yeah,
it should be interesting. Now, we do have a special guest here with us, Ryan Vandendick, the founder of Eden Industries and game director on Citizens of Earth. Welcome to the show, Ryan.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
So, We've worked together in the past,
yes,
so we have
true.
a little bit of a history. But I know you've been doing the indie dev thing for a while now,
mm-hmm.
So I'll be very curious to hear your story, because I think you know, people hear indie dev, and I think that means a lot of things nowadays. You know, like there's indie games that have like huge teams working on them.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like the film industry. Like an independent film can still have huge stars and lots of big money behind it, but usually it just means that there's no big studio or corporation kind of controlling it creatively. But you guys really are doing this indie and grassroots, and it's a very personal project for you guys, so I think it'll be cool to talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I guess we should mention that Frank is not with us.
No Frank.
He's actually pretty busy right now. He's kind of working two game dev jobs at the minute. At the moment, I think they're almost ready to ship Lost Orbit, I believe.
Yeah, I saw the Steam page went live today. So I don't know the release date, but it's coming up, obviously, if they got the page up. So very soon, watch out for that.
Yeah, so we'll definitely be letting you guys know about that when it's ready as well. But if we've timed this properly, I think Citizens of Earth is out as we speak, hopefully. So you can go get that on a multitude of platforms. Why don't you guys, we'll repeat it again, I'm sure.
Sure, yeah.
But what are the platforms that this game is going to be available on?
The platforms are PC on Steam right now, PS4, Vita, Wii U, and 3DS. And in North America and Europe. And that includes Australia.
Yeah,
that's pretty crazy. So, all right. So, is there any other stuff we need to mention off the top here? I mean, I guess, is there a web page for info on Citizens of Earth and stuff like that?
Yeah. So if you go to the Eden Industries homepage, just edenindustries.ca or atlas.com/citizensofearth, you'll be able to find all the info on one or both of those sites.
Okay, perfect. So, so before we get into talking about that, we do usually like to talk a little bit about gaming news here on the show. And there hasn't been really a ton of stuff since the last show. There's been a few things like the Sony-Microsoft hack, which I guess we won't really touch on because I don't really know what there is to say about it. But actually just today there was a big Nintendo Direct press conference, whatever you want to call it, that they do, and they talked about a lot of stuff that they have coming up, and it seems like it's worth talking about, especially since Ryan, I know you're a big Nintendo fan. Actually, maybe you can answer something for me.
Okay, shoot.
I've been developing this theory over the past few years.
Uh-oh.
I feel like every single game designer, and I know you have a bit of a programmer background as well, but I feel like anybody who's chosen a career in game design is automatically by default a Nintendo fanboy. Is this correct?
I think there's a high percentage. It's funny, I'll give you an example. So Alex, one of the guys making Lost Orbit, right? He teaches somewhere, maybe you guys know, but he was just mentioning the other day, oh, he has some student wants to be a game designer. Do I know anyone at Nintendo of Japan that I can hook him up with to get a job as a game designer at Nintendo? Now, obviously, the answer is no, because he has to speak Japanese and live there and a whole bunch of other stuff. But Yeah, I think you're right. People who want to design games, a lot of them tend to be fans of Nintendo and Nintendo games. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like every place that I've worked, it's something about designers specifically. Whenever there's some new Nintendo thing that launches, they're going nuts. Just today, there's a couple designers that sit beside me. They're calling around trying to get, you know, the Majora's Mask exclusive 3DS. And, you know, it's just like, but it's something, and it kind of makes sense. I mean, I don't know if I consider myself a Nintendo fanboy, but I certainly grew up on Nintendo. Mm-hmm. And I feel like if you are dedicated to the art of a fun game, making a game that is, you know, all about gameplay above all else, then you worship at the altar of Nintendo, basically. So.
Yeah, so I'll tell you the one interesting exception, and that is Silicon Knights, where all the designers, except me, hated Nintendo. So yeah, take that for what you will.
That is interesting, yeah. Okay, so the Nintendo Direct, let's just list off some of the stuff that was announced. Obviously, we just touched on the new 3DS. I guess there's a new 3DS XL. Don't know too much about it. I guess faster processor. I heard that it doesn't come with an ace. Sorry?
I think it has more memory.
Yeah, more memory.
Yeah.
And one strange thing, apparently it doesn't come with an AC adapter because they just assume you've already bought five of these things, so you don't need one, which is kind of hilarious. So they announced, the 3D remake of Legend of Zelda Majora's Mask. That was already announced, but obviously they have a special custom 3DS that ties in with that. New Fire Emblem game, some new amiibos, and I think the thing that I'm actually the most interested in is they announced they're going to be releasing some Wii games on the Wii U Virtual Console, which, you know, I wouldn't normally care that much, but then they announced that they're releasing the Metroid Prime trilogy for like $10.
Of course.
Which is like, that's a crazy deal. Like, that game is really hard to find. And
except in your library where you already have it.
I already have it, but now I can keep it unopened in the shrink wrap.
That game's good enough. You can buy that twice. That's all right.
Yeah, definitely.
I like that too announcement. I thought that was pretty neat because, like, one of the games they highlighted was Super Mario Galaxy 2.
Right.
Which, no, I don't own a Wii U yet, but the more I see of Nintendo, the more it's starting to tickle my fancy. And I played Mario Galaxy 2, but I didn't really play that much of it. So that would be a game that I'd be interested in going back and not having to hook up my Wii and still being able to give it a try.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the weird thing is I found that with the Virtual Console on the Wii U, certain games, like if they were available for the Wii Virtual Console, you could still play them on the Wii U, but you would have to go into the Wii emulation mode or whatever.
Yeah, the Wii menu of the Wii U menu.
Which doesn't allow you to actually play on the Wii U gamepad, right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Which is like the best part about playing some of these older games is being able to kind of have it on that little
gamepad. You can do the TV mode? You can do the gamepad only play on those?
Not on the Wii Virtual Console.
Yeah, that's not fun.
Yeah, right. Like you can use the gamepad as your TV, but you still have to use the original controller, like the Wii remote and the classic controller to actually control the game.
Oh, that's kind of strange.
Yeah.
So I guess there were a couple other little things. They announced that there's a new Mario versus Donkey Kong game, which I'm actually pretty excited about because I've liked all of these games. And it's going to be a cross-buy game. So you buy it on the Wii U, and you also get it on the 3DS or vice versa, which I don't know. I mean, that's something that Sony's been doing for a while and I think has been a pretty awesome little
perk
thing. Yeah, and I mean, it's a motivation to potentially buy both of those and, you know, I guess continue your game. I don't know. Did they actually say if there's like a cloud save feature or anything like that?
I'm not sure about it.
I guess that could be an issue if it's not there, but either way, it's a step in the right direction, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I find that strange that they announced that now and not when they had Super Smash Brothers. Because that would have seemed like even more of a like a match to have the cross buy going on.
I think that one they just expect to sell so many they don't want to do a cross buy, right?
Actually, that could be true too.
Such a huge seller, right?
I know the release dates didn't match up either, right? 3DS yeah. came out first.
3DS came out first, yeah.
I was really confused about that actually because to me, like the Wii U is the system that was kind of in trouble. I think they're starting to pick up steam a bit now, but you know, if you're trying to sell that system, why wouldn't you put out Smash Brothers on that system first? It just seemed weird. Cause
I think it almost doesn't matter. I mean, like, you know, the Wii U version, you can play up to 8 players now, which is crazy. The 3DS, I mean, unless you have other friends with a copy, you're basically playing by yourself. Like, it's such a different experience that I think it's almost irrelevant in terms of people buying it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's lots of people who bought both. And, you know, it is a different experience on both systems. But, yeah. So, and then there was one other thing. And I don't know if you guys think this is interesting or not, but I guess there's a mobile game that's pretty popular right now called Puzzle and Dragons.
Yeah.
Which I haven't played, but I've heard quite a bit about. And Nintendo is doing some sort of tie-in with this where they're going to actually release a Puzzle and Dragons Super Mario Edition for the 3DS, I believe. Is that correct? It's not actually on the mobile platforms.
I think it's on 3DS, yeah.
Little interruption there.
So a lot of people were thinking, oh, this is because people keep asking, why isn't Nintendo, you know, getting into mobile games? Because that's perfect for them because they do these sort of short, small, simple games that are easy to pick up and play. Like, why not put out some of these Nintendo games on, you know, iPhone or Android? And they've always said, yeah, you know, we're aware the mobile platform is something we want to work with, but they really don't want to just put their software on it because, you know, Nintendo's also in the hardware business and that's a big thing for them. So people thought this might be the first step towards that, but I'm not really sure exactly what it is or what it means. It just seems like they're taking a popular mobile game and bringing it to their handheld.
It sounds like almost they're trying to steal the mobile market people that haven't adapted yet.
Yeah.
To the 3DS, and they're just kind of, they're like branding it Mario, taking the game they love, because I think it's both games, right? It's the Mario one and the original.
Right, yeah.
So it sounds like they're like, hey, come on over here to Nintendo and buy our platform. You don't need that Apple product or that Android.
I guess in that sense, it could be pretty smart. Yeah, if there's, you know, a lot of people just playing games on their phones and Nintendo wants to remind them that, hey, there's some great games you can play on the go with this system too.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, I think the thing too with, you know, Nintendo and mobile and stuff is like, Nintendo's kind of got it figured out in terms of making games for their hardware. Like, they consistently make, you know, top quality games that sell well. And I think as soon as they're going to the mobile market, you know, it's a much more hit or miss kind of affair. And I think maybe just their, you know, tried and true formula that they've been doing for the past 3 decades just might not work anymore. So I think they've kind of got it down pat now. Maybe they're just comfortable staying there.
You're also dealing with potentially, especially if you go Android, kind of random SKUs of the product. So
yeah,
it's a lot harder to polish something to Nintendo's high quality bar.
Yeah.
And make sure it is at that high quality bar for every version of every platform you have out there.
Yeah.
Which is really not what they're about. I think they're more about the quality.
Yeah.
No matter how long it takes, and make sure it runs great. So
yep.
I'm with Ryan. I don't think that'll work for them on mobile.
Yeah. Now, Ryan, what's your take on the Amiibos? Are you a huge Amiibo fan? Are you collecting all of them? What's the deal?
So I've got 2 Amiibos right now. I've got Link and I've got Mario, you know, 2 classic heroes. You know, I like them even just as decoration. I like them. I have a lot of, you know, Nintendo toys littered across my desk. So even just as figurines, they're pretty cool. So I use them in Smash Bros. They're pretty fun as well, but I kind of expected a bit more of an investment. So, like, I don't know if you've seen how they work in Smash Bros., right? But you fight with them and you can feed them equipment to, like, level them up or just make them stronger, I guess. And I kind of just had my 2 Amiibos fight each other. And so you can level them up to 50. That's Nintendo's big thing, you know, level them up to 50. I mean, I had them fight a couple battles against each other, and within like an hour, they're level like 22. And I was like, well, this is weird. It's just going so fast. I sort of expected like a long-term investment. Like, these are my friends, my amiibos. We're in this for the long haul. And I felt like afternoon, I could be done with it. And so that part kind of felt weird, but no, it is really fun. And I say, even just as a cool collectible figurine, they're pretty neat. So.
Well, I know Frank has taken a pretty hard stance on this. I don't know if I'm guessing he never talked about it on the last episode because they weren't out yet.
It's not ringing a bell, yeah.
But on Film Junk, I believe he's mentioned that he is not a big fan because a couple of them are really hard to get already.
Yeah.
And that initially, right off the bat, turned him off because he's like, if I can't own them all, then forget it. I'm out.
Frank is not. So, he should not play Pokemon.
Yeah, I know. But I will admit, I mean, as much as I kind of have been kind of cynical about the whole thing, I have been tempted to pick one or two up, and I've just kind of been waiting for, like, if I could see one cool little feature in a game that I'm playing, I might be tempted to pick them up. I mean, I'm not playing Smash Brothers currently. Mm-hmm. I know there's a little bit of integration with Mario Kart, and I think they're adding something with Captain Toad maybe, but I don't know all the details. So
yeah, there's a bunch kind of planned. They're going to add a bunch of stuff. So, I mean, that's kind of cool too, right? You buy one, figurine once and you can use it for a bunch of games. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And it's cool that you don't actually need a base, that it just works with the Wii U controller. That's pretty cool. Okay. Anything else Nintendo wise you guys want to talk about?
Xenoblade Chronicles X looks awesome.
Yeah.
That could be my system seller right there.
Yeah.
I thought that was already... Is it just coming to 3DS or is it coming to...
No, so the new one's coming to Wii U, but they're remaking the original for the new 3DS, and one with the faster processor, the whole thing.
Okay.
So, yes.
Because you already played...
The original.
The original.
Yeah, I haven't beaten it actually, but I'm near the end. It's a long game, but so very
good.
Enjoyable.
So good.
Yeah. So, sounds like Ryan and I will be playing the new one when it comes out.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think there were a couple other games that were announced. I can't remember offhand what they were, but
I mean, I'm excited for Fire Emblem. I love the Fire Emblem games.
Oh, Fire Emblem was the other one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
But that's only 3DS, right? That was 3DS exclusive.
3DS. Yeah, yeah.
I think so. Yeah. I'm waiting for another Advance Wars. What the hell is going on with that?
Don't know.
Like, yeah, I mean, it's been a while, eh?
Maybe they can't put it out because it was Advance Wars. It was Game Boy Advance, but
well, it came on the DS, right? There was at least two.
That's
on
true.
The DS,
yeah,
so.
They did.
I mean, it's the same company that makes Fire Emblem, right? So I guess they're just got their hands full with Fire Emblem. I don't know.
Nintendo's just throwing that Fire Emblem money at them. So
yeah, I mean, I haven't played any of the Fire Emblem games, and I've been meaning to check them out because I hear they are kind of comparable. But
yeah,
yeah. So maybe I'll have to do that. What do you guys take right now on the status of Nintendo? Because, you know, we talked about how, I guess, last year they were kind of in trouble, and I know Super Mario 3D World came out and it got great reviews, but the sales were still not very good, and just a lot of people hadn't bought a Wii U yet. But I think after Smash Brothers, Mario Kart, and the fact that there wasn't a ton of stuff for PS4 or Xbox One at Christmas this year, I think Nintendo is kind of slowly turning it around. What do you guys think?
I think that there was a lot of good buzz around that Captain Toad Treasure Tracker game.
Yeah,
and I think as soon as that game came out, they seem to have this buzz around them that they are turning it around. They're going in the right direction. Actually, one thing I just remembered from that Nintendo Direct, I was surprised that they didn't show Star Fox because they had announced it a few months prior that it was coming this year before Zelda.
Mm.
So I was expecting that this would be a prime spot kind of to show something of it, but they didn't show anything.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're releasing Star Fox and Zelda this year, along with the other titles they announced, like, I think they are on the way up. I think catching Xbox, probably not. Definitely not going to catch PS4, I don't think. But I think they're definitely not trending down anymore.
Right.
Yeah, you know, the funny thing with Nintendo is, like, I was talking to one of the guys. He quit Nintendo now, but he was the dude in charge of all the indie and digital releases kind of stuff for Nintendo of America. And he was saying, especially when Super Mario 3D World came out, they didn't have enough Wii U like consoles in store to meet demand. So people come to the store, they want to buy the game because it, you know, looks really great. They don't have it in stock. So, you know, they don't buy it. And then, you know, the Christmas season ends. By the time they get more stock in, man, people don't care anymore. So it's kind of this constant mismatch of like supply and demand. I mean, same thing happened, you know, on the GameCube, right? Metroid Prime comes out. Everyone wants to buy it. Well, no one's been stocking GameCube. You know what I mean? So then people don't buy it. And it's just this weird, like, supply and demand never lining up for, you know, Nintendo. So.
Well, I know Nintendo has been accused in the past of actually trying to artificially create demand by not having enough supply. Like, that kind of was the case when the Wii first launched. But yeah, it just kind of seems weird that, you know, with the Wii U, that that would be the case. And I don't know. I mean, I just think there weren't a ton of games initially, but...
Well, it's not just what Nintendo wants, right? Like, the retailers order what they think will sell, right? So,
yeah, I guess that makes sense.
Yeah. But the other thing, too, with Nintendo, I mean, you know, they make so much money for their shareholders that they're always kind of doing what's best for that, you know what I mean? So, like, I would say, well, Nintendo, you know, like, spend some of that Fire Emblem money and make Advance Wars. And Nintendo's like, no, you know, we're maximizing our return on our shareholders, and that's their goal as a, you know, corporate entity, right? So they make a lot of weird decisions for that goal that sometimes doesn't make so much sense, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird because then they will announce something weird, like they've been talking about this health sensor thing.
Yeah, the vitality sensor, yeah.
Well, is that what it is? Like, did they actually confirm that?
Well, they announced that, like, I mean, I don't know if they confirmed that, but of course they announced it a long time ago.
I think that was for the Wii.
Back in 2009, they announced that.
I remember, Ryan, you went crazy about that.
Oh, I was so excited.
You were coming up with tons of game ideas for that thing.
I was like, yeah, I think it does have a lot of really cool, I mean, because at the time we were at, obviously, Silicon Knights. I mean, Vitality Sensor and Eternal Darkness, man, that would have been great. But obviously, for a lot of reasons, that wouldn't have panned out, but I think it's got potential. I mean, we'll see what Nintendo does with it. But
well, so this is the thing: they did announce at the end of October that they're working on a device that helps you sleep or something like that, and they haven't really like officially like given any launch information or even a name for it. But it's just another one of these weird little Nintendo things where you're like, what? And, you know, sometimes they talk about stuff like this and it doesn't actually come out, I guess, like the vitality sensor. I don't know if this is the evolution of the vitality sensor. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and then every now and then they do something weird and then it hits and it's like, you know, totally something nobody expected. So I don't know. I'm always curious to see what they're going to do next.
Well, you know, the one thing they've always said is, you know, they're not competing just with, you know, what other games you're playing. They're competing with all other uses of your time. Well, if people are sleeping a third of their life, Nintendo's got to tap into that sleeping market, man.
Yeah, we need to be able to play some games while we're sleeping.
Maybe this is the evolution.
Yeah.
Next, you'll be wearing a little headset that manipulates your dreams into Mario characters.
Well, it's like that thing when, you know, you've been playing Tetris all night and you go to bed and you just see the shapes in your head.
Yeah,
like
they're
tapping into that. I feel it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Nintendo dream.
Yeah. So anyway, I don't know. Yeah. It's like over the past year or so, like I was kind of complaining because it felt like Nintendo was doing a lot of rehashing, but I don't know. I feel like I've changed my mind a little bit on them, or they've proven themselves once again. So, that being said, I'm not buying another 3DS, but I probably will buy Majora's Mask because I never played it the first time.
Who are you kidding? You're going to buy this day one.
No, I am not. So, okay, we forgot to mention at the top of the show, we're also going to get into something that's kind of a news topic, kind of something else. We're going to talk in Hot Button about day one patches and broken games and how this is affecting the industry. So we'll get to that in a bit, but I guess the other thing that was a part of the Nintendo Direct was
Citizen's Birth was featured.
Yes.
We had about a 30-second spot or so.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ryan, why don't you talk about it?
Yeah. I mean, well, that was pretty exciting. I mean, I watch all the Nintendo Directs that, you know, they've been doing for however long. And I mean, they're in a lot of ways sort of my, you know, favorite Nintendo source of news, right? It's directly, you know, from the horse's mouth kind of thing, right? They got Iwata-san up there doing his spiel, and it's awesome. So yeah, to see Citizens of Earth there was great. I mean, obviously the company was amazing, right? You're, you know, in the same breath as Fire Emblem and Mario and Zelda and then Citizens of Earth. I mean, you can't get much better than that.
Yeah, it's pretty cool to see that. And I think in the E3 Nintendo press conference, we got like a tiny little logo somewhere.
Yeah, I think I saw something.
Yeah, but this was actually, I don't know the guy who was talking over, but that was a Nintendo guy like kind of doing a spiel for Citizens, which was kind of cool and unexpected as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it was our old E3 trailer, which is the only, you know, unfortunate thing is, you know, it's 6 months sort of out of date in terms of what was being shown. But no, I mean, still, it was really great to see that. And, you know, we sort of missed out on some of the holiday footage Nintendo was planning on doing since, you know, the release date slipped a bit. But, you know, it's just, you know, to kind of get back, you know, right in there with Nintendo Direct was awesome.
And perfect timing, too, since we're coming out next week.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or today, whenever the show comes out.
Yeah, whenever you're listening to this.
Out now.
Right. So, all right, well, let's talk about Citizens of Earth. I guess, why don't you guys give your backgrounds on, like, you know, where you've worked previously and sort of how you got into game development initially, and then we'll get to the actual idea that became Citizens of Earth after that.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So my first job, as a game developer, was with Next Level Games in Vancouver. I was working on Mario Strikers first, and then Spider-Man Friend or Foe. And actually, that was while I was still a co-op at university. So I did that for a year, came back, finished the degree, went to Silicon Knights as a designer this time. So I was a programmer, Next Level designer at Silicon Knights. Worked, you know, first year on whatever ritualist box, whatever you want to call it, got canceled. Half a year on X-Men Destiny, saw the writing on the wall, hightailed it out of there, back to Next Level as a programmer, was on Ghost Recon for the Wii and Luigi's Mansion Dark Moon on 3DS. And I was working on sort of Waveform kind of during that time. I had sort of a special privilege to work on it while I was, you know, sort of working at Next Level, which is pretty uncommon to kind of be able to do your own thing on your own time. But yeah, did that for, I mean, I guess it was mid-2009 to end of 2011. It was like 2.5 years, I guess. And then quit, shipped Waveform, and been doing indie ever since. So that's sort of my spiel.
And so we, Ryan and I, and Sean, all met at Silicon Knights when Ryan started there. Sean and I had already been working there. Mm-hmm. Sean a little longer than I had. And Ryan and I sort of like developed a relationship there about, hey, it'd be cool to make games. We kind of noticed that we had the same taste in games.
Well, we went to the same university, had like friends in common.
Yeah, that's right.
Sort of a funny kind of background, but yeah.
Yeah, I found his love of Nintendo hilarious. I am not a designer, apparently, so.
So you can like other things, that's acceptable.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And then, so I guess to pick up the Citizen story, Ryan shipped Waveform right around the time I had been laid off from Bedlam Games in Toronto, which had been working on some Dungeons & Dragons titles. So I had been in contact with Ryan. I said, hey, why don't I take my knowledge, start making like a base for a new game, the next game we're going to do, because I didn't know what I was going to do after that. Yeah. Jobs were pretty limited in Toronto at the time. So I started writing the tech for Citizens, which I think was July of 2011.
Yeah, somewhere around
I think that's when it would have been. So I started kind of working in my spare time, basically full-time actually, because I didn't have a job, writing tech that kind of powers Citizens of Earth in the background. And then when Ryan rolled off of Waveform, he picked up the design on, well, actually, it wasn't even Citizens of Earth at the time. It was some other RPG.
We kind of got to step back, actually, to because, like, back in 2007, I made an RPG prototype that, I mean, I think it's pretty fun, even to this day. And so, I mean, I guess, you know, Andrew liked it. I'd shown him before. So, yeah, when he finished at Bedlam, he started making sort of the tech for that game, to bring that RPG prototype into a full game. So he was working on that. And then when I finished Waveform, yeah, I kind of came on for sort of the, you know, gameplay code and the design. And we were still working on that game for a couple months until, yeah, at some point we decided, just, you know, talking to the other kind of folks who were, you know, thinking about collaborating about what we wanted to do. And, you know, I actually kind of transitioned into Citizens of Earth. But all of Andrew's tech, you know, kind of worked for that too. So it's kind of merged from, you know, different RPG idea into what became Citizens of Earth.
Yeah, and I think we were working on that, and then we kind of just had like a bunch of pitch ideas out there, right? We kind of threw it to everyone and said, you know, what does everyone like?
Yeah, we had a whole bunch of RPG kind of concepts, ideas, and Citizens of Earth. Well, I mean, at the time it wasn't called Citizens of Earth. It was just the idea of, like, you know, you can recruit regular people as the heroes. That was sort of the idea. And that really kind of, yeah, captured everyone's, I guess, imagination and interest.
And I think we also had an idea of sort of like the wacky, mismatched characters.
Yeah, yeah.
Drew in a lot of the artists.
Mm-hmm. Although, ironically, that didn't really become a big thing in the game.
Yeah, we had this big design to almost like dynamically create new characters. We'd have like kind of like lower body, upper body, head.
Yeah.
And it would like dynamically create enemies almost on the fly, depending on the area you were in.
Yeah.
And that proved to be not worthwhile.
Yeah, we didn't. Yeah. That was abandoned fast. But I mean, I guess, yeah, you're right. Like just the idea of it and sort of the humor and the style, proved interesting. So.
And actually, our original code name for the game was Starbound.
Starbound. Right.
Which was funny because then that Starbound game came out and we're like, yeah. Oh crap, well, we definitely have to change the name of the game now.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, Citizens of Earth, obviously, I think is obviously a much better name.
Yeah, we had we had like a couple days where we brainstormed just a whole ton of names.
Well, because what was happening was this is the beginning of 2013. We were about to announce the game for the first time and we had a bunch of, you know, press sites lined up to cover the announce of the game, and we didn't have a title yet. And so, yeah, we had a bunch of big meetings like, well, what are we going to call this thing? We're announcing to the world in like 3 days. What are we going to call it? So,
Untitled RPG Project.
Yeah.
The next big thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So, question, what, like, how many is Eden Industries essentially just you, like, or like, are there other people aside from you two that were involved in the early stages of this game?
I mean, so Scott, who does the music, was involved right from the beginning. He did the music for Waveform, and, you know, we just had a great rapport. And I said, well, hey, look, we're making another game. Do you want to be in on it? He said, yeah, absolutely, right from the start. So he was sort of in it. Although, I mean, he wasn't actively doing a lot with us day to day. I mean, until we figured out sort of what game we were making, you know, he wasn't like composing music yet, but he was on board for sure.
Right.
I mean, other than that, not really. No one's, you know, who I guess persisted to the end. You know, we had a couple people, Robin, Vincent, who, you know, we worked with also at Siliconites, and he did the level design of Waveform. I mean, he was sort of on board in the early bit, but didn't really do anything. Alex was going to do the art. He did, you know, he and Chris helped out for the art for Waveform.
The guys from Pixel Knots, who we had on the last show?
I think so.
Yeah. They helped us out a bit in the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Alex did.
Alex, that's right.
Yeah. So he was going to, you know, he was going to be the artist and he was going to help out, but, you know, got busy with Lost Orb and that kind of stuff. So he kind of dropped out. So there were a couple people, but no one, I guess, that, yeah, was really core or, you know, persisted to the end.
Well, Chris, our level designer, came on pretty early as well.
Yeah, he came on pretty early. And he actually helped out a bit on Waveform as well. And, I mean, I obviously knew him from working at Next Level with him. So, yeah, he came in, yeah, I guess it would have been end of July, August 2012. So, yeah, it's pretty early, yeah.
And we had a lot of trouble actually finding artists that week. Because one of the things that maybe isn't known is that we don't really have any money. So,
yeah, I kind of wanted to get into that because, I mean, that's the reality of making an indie game is you're starting from scratch with nothing. And unless you can find a publisher early on to fund the project, which doesn't happen very often, at least, you know, if you're just starting out and you're not that well known, yeah, you're funding it yourself. And I know, Ryan, like when you were doing Waveform, the way you were able to make that happen is, like you said, you were working like basically a day job.
Yeah.
And then you came home at night and then you worked, you know, like basically another 8 hour day doing
that's right.
that, right?
Yeah, yeah, yep.
And so that's crazy.
That, yeah, that pretty much funded the game, yeah.
Yeah, used his salary to pay for art and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So I didn't have a job. Ryan was full indie. So we had literally zero income.
Yeah.
So we were working.
Well, I had, you know, I just shipped Waveform. So I had some like revenue coming in from that, which funded a lot of the early, you know, art and animation stuff before we got a publisher. But
right.
Yeah, yeah, that was kind of how we were able to manage that. But
not enough for a full game, though. No. We had enough for like the prototype level.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's the tricky thing too is, you know, I feel like there's indie developers who maybe are just coming out of school and maybe you're still living with your parents or something. You don't have a ton of bills. Maybe that's a good time where you can just kind of do your own thing and start something. But if you're already out, you know, established, you've maybe got a house, got other responsibilities and
gotta pay them bills
and you have a job and, but you want to go indie, like how do you do that? Like that transition is extremely hard.
Mm-hmm.
And I know in Canada there's some grants and things you can apply for that can help a little bit. I don't know all the details on that stuff, but did you guys ever look into any of that or no?
Yeah, I looked into it a bit. I mean, there's, so first of all, I mean I'm based in BC, right? Ontario has more than BC does in terms of government grants. Yeah, you know, there's some, you know, Telefilm and all this kind of stuff gives grants, but I don't know. It just didn't really seem the right fit for us, you know? And I mean, I guess, you know, we can kind of come to this, but, you know, when you compare it to a publisher like Atlas, you know, which is just so synonymous with RPGs, I mean, people aren't going to be like, this game was funded by the government of Canada? I got to play this, right? But they say like, well, this game was made by Atlas. People are like, whoa, okay, well, I'll play it. Because you know, there's fans of Atlas buying games. No fans of the government of Canada playing games. You know what I mean? So,
right. So, but yeah. I mean, I guess just in terms of like how you guys were able to bring people in then to work with you. Like, what was your strategy there?
I mean, you know, the big thing was that we'd already shipped a game. You know, so having Waveform on Steam with, you know, a really high Metacritic, like that was huge. You know, like so our art director, Robin, I even asked him later, I said, hey, you know, like, why did you, you know, decide to join up with us? Cause you know, he worked, you know, for free. Like, we didn't pay him as well. He's in kind of the same boat as us. And he said, well, you know, I like the idea. And I saw that you had shipped a game at high quality. I knew you would, you'd go there to the end. You weren't going to like, you know, crap out halfway through. So I think that was huge, is just having, you know, that credibility, you know, something we can point to that says, you know, we can make a game, we can make it good quality, you know, we'll ship this thing, you know. So that was a big one. And I think another, you know, huge thing is just getting people to believe in the vision of it. And so I think even by this time we had a prototype, you know, Andrew was saying he was working on tech for a long time and we really reused a lot of what we had in Waveform. So we had something that we could show people too. And it wasn't just an idea, you know, floating in the air, but like it was something you could play, you could kind of get a sense for it. So that was big too, that, you know, we had a real product in our hands, albeit at a very early phase, but something that people could see. It wasn't, you know, it had some tangibility, it had some concreteness to it, was also a big factor.
Right. And in terms of, bringing in different artists and stuff, like, was it a problem, I guess, for in terms of consistency and stuff like that? Like, because I would think if you want to have like a certain style to your art, you got to have people coming in that are going to adhere to that style. But if you have, you know, people coming in and doing something for a couple months and then somebody else mm-hmm. coming in, like, is that a problem or was it a problem for you guys?
Well, it was a problem. And I think especially because we didn't really have an art director in the early days, right? So I mentioned, you know, Robin sort of became that, but at first he was just doing character art. And, you know, that sort of position grew as, you know, he sort of established himself. But it was hard sort of at the beginning to kind of unite all these different artists that we were kind of collaborating with. And, you know, the only kind of direction was from a bunch of people who weren't artists, you know, myself or Andrew or Chris kind of, you know, talking about what we wanted. Well, you know, yeah, we're not artists. It's hard for us to talk the language and sort of communicate that. But I think in the end, it became a lot better once Robin was able to kind of direct some of the contractors and show exactly what he wanted, kind of unify them under sort of his aesthetic style. That seemed to work a bit better, would you say, Andrew?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in the early days, we basically had people just coming in, kind of working, like Sean was saying, for a couple months. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't maybe so much that they couldn't hit the mark. I mean, most artists are pretty good at what they do. They can adhere to different styles, like, you know, to within a certain degree. But I think it was just that, well, I know Ryan for sure, and I, and probably all the other guys, we had like certain benchmarks. I wouldn't call them milestones, but benchmarks we wanted to hit by certain times of the year just to show our progression. So we were actually like going to ship this thing. And when you go for like 2 months with an artist and then 2 months without an artist, it's like really hard to see the progress you want. And I know that was hard for me because a lot of the times I would spend like stressing, trying to contact any artist I knew just to get someone in the door to make like some character animations for us. The sprite animation is all hand-drawn stuff. So it takes a while to do. So you can't just kind of like, a lot of artists know that'll take a while to do. So they're not just willing to jump in and like, you know, it's not a matter of rigging up a model in Max and then animating it through keyframes or anything like that. And it's a little more difficult, a little more nitpicky. So people were pretty against kind of signing up for no money.
Yeah.
And when you want to see the game progress at a certain pace, but you don't have any artists, it really, really kills the flow of that.
Yeah.
And that was our biggest thing.
Yeah. And then, I mean, a big thing too was once we started talking Atlas, we didn't even sign anything yet. But they're like, well, we really want to see more animation, you know, like, which at the time was very strange to me because I was at the time playing their Shin Megami Tensei 4 for the 3DS, in which all the enemies have like 2 frames of animation. So for them to look at ours and say, it needs more animation, I felt was a bit strange. But anyway, so that also sort of added sort of a layer of complexity because, like Andrew was saying, we had people that was hard to get, you know, even, you know, these hand-drawn animations at the level we were originally going for, let alone kind of to meet Atlas's idea of like a really fluid, well animated game. So that just kind of just ratcheted up the challenge too.
Yeah. And I would assume like, you know, obviously once you guys were working with Atlas and stuff, like there were deadlines involved that you wanted to hit. And like, how do you do that when you don't necessarily have like this reliable art staff that are going to be there and delivering all this stuff?
It was really stressful because we really wanted to show at GDC 2013 and meet publishers and try to, you know, we were just planning to launch the Kickstarter later in March, a few weeks after GDC. So we had that in mind. We wanted to get GDC so we could get some press coverage and show some publishers. And then all of a sudden we are like struggling to get the art even to like a basic level where we can show something. Cause I mean, the art at that time wasn't that complex. I mean, I don't even know if our enemies had more than 2 frames of animations in battle at that time, but,
I think they had more than 2 frames.
Oh, okay. Well, not many though.
They didn't have many. No, they didn't have that many.
And, so here we are wanting to show something that's of a pretty high quality bar. We knew the gameplay was there, but you know, people get turned off by art so easily, especially nowadays. Yeah. And we're even seeing it now with Citizens. I mean, it seems like the internet buzz is either people love the art style or they absolutely hate it. So, you know, it's kind of lose-lose in some regard.
I was going to ask, like, how did you guys decide on that art style? Because it seems like, you know, if you're going for an RPG that's, you know, maybe influenced by the 16-bit era or something like that, like pixel art seems to be the go-to thing. Was there a reason you guys didn't go that route?
And I think the big thing for me was that, I guess there were, you know, 2 things. One was the game had a modern setting. And I just feel like, you know, pixel art, I mean, it has such a retro feel that I felt it'd be kind of weird to push this modern setting, modern theme with the vice president of the world in politics, and yet look like, you know, Final Fantasy One. You know what I mean? It just, it felt like there's some sort of dissonance there. And then the other thing too is, I mean, if you look at Earthbound, which is obviously an inspiration for the game, I mean, the game had, you know, pixel art, obviously. I mean, it was on the Super Nintendo. They kind of all had pixel art. But it still felt like they were trying to do a different style, a more, you know, cartoony, lively style. And so I felt like, you know, going with this sort of vibrant, cartoony style we have now was maybe a testament to what that game also would have been if it was, you know, released now, if you know what I mean. So it was sort of that. And another thing was, I feel like pixel art, it's hard to release it on a bunch of different platforms if you do pixel art. Obviously, you know, when you have screen resolution differences between, you know, PS4 and Wii U, you know, like 1920 by 1080, down to the 3DS's, you know, 400 by 240, pixel art really has a very different meaning, you know, and it's to be hard to use the same asset across all those platforms. Whereas, you know, they sort of stylized, you know, high res 2D now, we're able to kind of shrink it down to the 3DS and it just looks perfect.
Yeah, it looks almost exactly the same.
Yeah, exactly.
Smaller scale.
Yeah.
Did you guys ever talk about going 3D at all, or was it always 2D all the way?
I don't think we ever talked about
2D.
Yeah, 2D. I like 2D.
We're pretty big fans of the 2D Super Nintendo style RPGs. So, I mean, that's kind of, I don't know, we never really talked about it, and it just kind of fit right in with the game. Mm-hmm. And never turned around. Plus, the tech requirements for a 3D game is a lot more. And we already knew we were going to be tight on art.
Yeah.
Artists, mainly animators. So going 3D just would have complicated it, because then not only do you need animators, you need modelers. So it's just, it was more of a, just having no money, and we were struggling to find animators anyway. So,
mm-hmm. I mean, I think a lot of, obviously most indie games seem to be 2D, and there's a reason for that. But I do wonder if, you know, talking about the trouble with finding artists and stuff, like, I think a lot of artists that want to get into games, they learn 3D.
That's
modeling
true.
And animation. Yeah. So if you're looking for people coming out of school, there would probably be more of those around.
Definitely.
But it's kind of unfortunate that all the indie games are doing the 2D thing. And yeah.
Well, it's definitely the case.
Yeah. But I think, you know, I think it's really good that it went 2D. I mean, we're able to support so many platforms because we have just a, you know, yeah, 2D game. If we went, you know, crazy 3D, probably we wouldn't be able to ship on 3DS, probably not Vita. So I think it was, in the end, a really good kind of move.
Right. Now, why don't we talk about that a little bit? Because you guys are shipping on pretty much all the major platforms on the same day, which I have never seen done for an indie game ever, I don't think. Is that like, that seems like a pretty crazy accomplishment for a small team.
Yeah, I mean, there are some, like, you know, a fellow Vancouver dev, Brian Provinciano, he made Retro City Rampage, and he released on a whole smattering of platforms as well. Mm-hmm. But as far as I know, I think we're the first RPG to do it. I don't know of another RPG that has released on 5 platforms simultaneously before.
Well, I don't even know if Retro City Rampage was out. Like, wasn't it not... There was one major console it wasn't out on for some reason. I feel like maybe it was the Wii or the Wii U.
Yeah, I think that was later.
Could be, yeah, I don't know.
But then again, we're not shipping on the Xbox One, so, I mean, it's kind of a trade-off there.
Yeah.
Right, that's true. But, so, like, what was the process of that, I guess? Like, I don't know how much detail you want to go into with that, but, like, it seems like it would be a lot of... because people may not realize, but like, there's a lot of little nitpicky things and a lot of differences between all the platforms. So to be able to do all that simultaneously.
Well, actually, before we talk about that, why don't we talk about sort of like how that came up, which is through the Kickstarter failing and signing
with
Atlas.
Right, okay, that's a good idea. I was going to ask about the Kickstarter because I forgot about that. But that was part of your funding. But
from Atlas.
At least that was part of the plan for your funding.
The original plan was PC only and Wii U if we hit the stretch goal.
Right.
And well, I mean, we had different stretch goals in the Kickstarter. We had Wii U, 3DS, PS4, Vita. We had the whole thing. But
they're quite a bit higher benchmark.
Well, because at the time, Nintendo had already sent us a Wii U dev kit. because we had met with them at GDC and they liked it. And so we're like, oh, we'll send you a dev kit. So that was sort of, yeah, I guess at the top of our list just because we already had the hardware in our hands.
So, but so this was all before Atlas came on board, right?
Before they came on board, yes. But we had been talking to them for a while. So we met them at GDC 2013. We didn't like sign any deal until, it wasn't until January 2014, I think, we actually signed a deal with them. But we were talking to them in the intervening 9 months, like, and you know, we talked to them about Kickstarter, our plans. We showed them the Kickstarter page. They gave us feedback on our Kickstarter page, like, which is very nice of them. But so, you know, they were always around, if you know what I mean. But yeah, nothing was official yet when we did the Kickstarter.
Okay, so Kickstarter, the at that point, you guys had, you know, a prototype of the game.
Yeah.
And the Kickstarter was mainly to finish the art. Is that right?
Or... art and levels, content, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Was the big one. Yeah.
And so what happened with that?
Well, a couple things, I guess, happened. One is I found out, much to my surprise, that people did not like the fact that we said we were inspired by Earthbound. Most of the feedback was either, this game looks nothing like Earthbound, these guys are, you know, what are they smoking, have they never played Earthbound? And the other half of people said, this looks too much like Earthbound, they're clearly copying it, you know, how dare they, you know, these, you know, sacrilege, right? So that was a surprising, I don't know, reaction. Don't you think, Andrew?
Yeah, big time. I mean, we obviously didn't set out to make Earthbound.
No.
We just liked things about Earthbound. Like the
and Nintendo is not making it, right? So
yeah.
I always thought, well, why not? Let's do it, you know?
But I mean, the thing is too, with Kickstarter, you usually want to associate your game with something, because like people aren't just going to read the name Citizens of Earth and be like, oh, I'm going to donate to
this. That's what we thought.
But, I mean, that's what Kickstarter is all about, is saying like, oh, our game is sort of like this game that you already love, so give us a chance or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, you know, on paper, I feel like we had everything right going in. I mean, we had a real product, you know, so it wasn't going to be vaporware like a lot of Kickstarter games going to turn out to. We had a real product. We had, you know, we'd already shipped a game, Waveform, like, so we had something to say for ourselves as an indie studio. Most of us had worked for years at other companies, you know, Siliconites, Next Level, Andrew's, you know, Bedlam, you know, wherever else. And, you know, we had a ton, like Robin made tons of art unique for the Kickstarter page. Like, it looked great. So on paper, I felt like we were, you know, we had it all right. But, like I said, the, you know, people, Andrew saying, you know, some people hated the art style. They thought, ah, it's, why isn't it pixel art, right? Why is this cartoony? Why, you know, the Earthbound went both ways. Why is it this? Why isn't it that? And then, you know, there's a lot of people just, you know, who are these guys making an RPG? I never heard of them, you know, and just, I don't know, just, yeah, didn't get the word of mouth, or the right word of mouth, I guess, to kind of keep it going.
We had trouble getting visibility too. It seemed like every attempt we made to try to get some coverage just fell flat. And we had a hard time getting any sort of press coverage, I think.
I mean, well, we did get some, but it just didn't really matter. I mean, like, I think we were mentioned, you know, Kotaku had something, if I recall. I mean, there was coverage around, but just, like I said, yeah, not the right coverage, or not the one that mattered, I guess. And there's not enough, you know, critical mass to keep the ball rolling, for sure.
So do you guys think that... So when was that again? That was 2013?
That was...
End of March, I think?
No. That was October.
Oh, October 2013.
Yeah.
October 2013. Do you feel like at that point, was Kickstarter starting to be... like people were sick of hearing about all these projects that people wanted funded? Or was it still kind of going strong at that point? I'm trying to remember.
I mean, I still feel like... I think it was both. I think it was going strong. People were starting to get tired of games that were hyped to no end and that never came out, or that met, you know, didn't really meet their expectations.
Right.
But, you know, that being said, certainly there are other games, you know, getting funded all, you know, all the time. So sort of a mix, I guess.
If I recall, it was sort of right at the point where Kickstarter starting to be really about companies that already have a really established brand coming out with new ideas and then people funding those.
Right.
And so then, sort of like lesser known people just kind of get thrown to the side. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I think that was sort of like right. I think if I recall, the Double Fine Adventure had just kind of crushed all records. And then Wasteland 2 had come out, I think, a month before us or maybe even less. And just gotten like tons of money. Right. But all those guys had established IPs and mm-hmm. names behind them. So I think we were right after sort of that wave of Kickstarter projects.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Kickstarter fails. What's the next step? What did you guys do at that point?
So, you know, I was considering really reducing the scope of what the game was going to be. You know, because at the time we had, you know, we had a prototype. It was fun. We had some good content, but yeah, without money, you know, it definitely seemed like we weren't going to finish the art. We wouldn't be able to finish the content. So just kind of package up what we had, release it as, you know, Citizens of Earth Chapter 1, or you know, some, you know, reduced kind of portion like that. But like I mentioned, we were still talking to Atlas about it, and you know, even with the Kickstarter failure, it didn't seem to faze them. They're just like, oh, we still believe in the game. We still think it's great. We still want to be involved. So it kind of just, you know, we closed the book on Kickstarter and just went right into continued discussion with Atlas. So
it kind of proceeded. We had talked about trying to do it ourselves, but it just wasn't going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, you know, I had been, you know, paying for all the stuff up to that point. And, you know, I was running out of money to, you know, to keep it going. Especially when you're talking about a full-fledged RPG, there's a lot of costs. So I wouldn't, you know, just on my own kind of bank account, wasn't going to be able to do the whole thing. So,
right. So, so what was the decision-making process for that then? Like in terms of, I guess for people who might be working on an indie game or thinking about working on an indie game, and if you have the option to have a relationship with a publisher and maybe, you know, sign a deal with them. Mm-hmm. Like what were the benefits for you guys and what were some of the things maybe you were worried about with that?
Well, you're always, you know, worried about them changing what the game's about, you know, like sort of, you know, coming in and saying, well, change this, do that, and kind of destroying the vision of it. But I don't really feel that they did that. I think we controlled sort of what the game was about and stayed true to the vision. What do you think, Andrew?
Yeah, I think so. At the beginning, I was really suspect of that. Only, I think, because I had put a ton of work into writing the dialogue for our initial section of game. And Atlas came in and basically, like, whitewashed that whole thing.
Yeah, they did change all the dialogue in the game. But, I mean, I think they did a good job of it.
Yeah, they did. They really did. Yeah. And they did keep some of our jokes in that we did have and things like that. But the good thing is that they liked what we had, gameplay mechanics and game, like all of our kind of scripted scenes, we didn't really have to change around at all. They kind of just wrote script into what we already had been doing.
Well, and I think too, that, you know, like I myself or you or whoever, you know, wrote dialogue and wrote sort of what the moment was going to be. And yeah, you know, to their credit, they kind of just framed all of their dialogue, the new dialogue, within the context of that scene.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think that worked out well. You know, like Andrew and myself, I mean, we're not writers, you know what I mean? So, you know, they had guys that were experienced in dialogue and, you know, scripts and that sort of thing. And so it was great. You know, they obviously brought their expertise and they let us kind of do what we do, which is make, you know, fun games. So that worked out really well.
And so the obvious advantage there is that they can bring experience that a small indie team would never have. Mm-hmm. I mean, unless you know a writer that is, you know, well-versed in whatever type of game you're going to make, especially an RPG where there's quite a bit of dialogue requirements.
So much dialogue, yeah. And I think it really paid off. You know, when we went to E3, at the time, you know, Atlas brought the game to get all the voice acting down, and we, you know, on the show floor, people were cracking up left and right when they read the dialogue and heard the voices. And so it really worked out really well.
Okay, so, and obviously, so there's money involved in the deal as well, which allows you guys to say, okay, we're going to, you know, knuckle down. We've got some money to keep us afloat for a while. Let's get this game finished. And I guess at that point, they also were pushing to have more platforms than you guys had originally intended, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And I think a tighter schedule, because I think originally they wanted October 2014, which,
yeah, that's,
and
yeah.
I think, so we signed the deal January 2014?
Yeah, that's right.
So that's like 9 months to do the, basically the entire port for four platforms you've never, or some
well,
you've never worked with.
And actually, I mean, it wasn't even 9 months, right? Because they originally wanted the final build delivered to them July 15th.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Which is like 6.5 months.
Yeah. Right? So that's when Ryan hired me full time.
Well, so the thing is, right, is, you know, Atlas, they gave us some money, but, you know, it wasn't a ton of money. Like, it wasn't enough to really change what we were doing. It was enough to be like, okay, I don't need to drain my bank account hiring artists. So the money went to, you know, I was able to hire Andrew full time, pay, you know, contract artists, buy the development kits for the other platforms. But that was basically
cheap.
They're not cheap, yeah. But that was mainly in the localization of all the languages. But definitely, you know, the majority of people were still just working for free the whole time. Like, it wasn't like, okay, finally we got money. Let's take it easy. We're all getting a fat paycheck. Like, you know, not even close.
So, like, how many people were working on this game at its peak, would you say?
At least a dozen.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you know, again, not all full-time, right? I guess Andrew and myself were probably only full-time, a bunch of part-time, and then, you know, a bunch of contractors, but...
So, that whole, you know, 6 to 9 month period there where you guys were basically getting shit done... What was the process there? Because I know, like, you were, you know, watching your son half the day and then developing
right.
the other half of the day, and you guys are working remotely as well with all these other people. Like, this seems like a nightmare to me.
Well, Ryan can speak more on the, like, the content stuff, because when he signed me on, my sole role basically became making sure it runs on PS4, Vita, Wii U, and 3DS.
Yeah.
And my expertise is not in rendering, like the drawing of things on there. So we actually hired another guy for a 3 months or so-ish?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, to help me get that part done, and then I brought over all the other code. And Sean, like you were alluding to earlier, there's like a ton of little nitpicky things that can come up on each platform, and they're all different. And so my main role, I stopped doing any sort of creative work except for feedback here and there.
Yeah.
And focused entirely on making sure it ran on those platforms. And then, Ryan, why don't you talk about, like, on...
Yeah. Well, I mean, in general, it was a nightmare, to be honest. you know, organizing, yeah, like, the efforts of a large team, I'd say it was about, you know, 12 at its peak, all remotely, you know, so we're all in, you know, different parts of, I guess, North America, Canada and the US, with, you know, so yeah, big team, all remote, almost no money. So I can't, you know, like pay people to get stuff done. I'm just sort of hoping they'll do it out of sort of, you know, their own motivation.
Right.
It was crazy. I mean, you know, like, I'm sure, you know, Andrew worked a ton. I mean, I worked, you know, from January till December, it was almost 100 hours a week, every week for me. Just, you know, trying to get everything done and you know, pick up slack where, you know, things kind of fell through just because of, you know, not having the money to pay the people we needed. You know, someone's got to do it, you know, so that, you know, I would kind of pick up that a lot, but it was hard. And then, you know, the other thing too is, of course, everything we're doing, Atlas has feedback. So,
right.
You know, we'll be like, okay, finally, here's the build, send it to them. Let's start on the next bit. And they're like, well, actually, that was good, but we really would like to see these, you know, dozen things change. It's like, well, okay, let's add those into what we already were going to do. And it just kind of adds and kind of snowballs.
That's a pretty typical problem with the publisher-developer relationship that doesn't change when you're an indie.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, and I don't begrudge Atlas making those comments. I think, you know, most of the time their comments were great and, you know, they were on target, but... It certainly, didn't make things easier having to sort of accommodate that with, again, you know, like, you know, we didn't get any more money. We didn't get any more time. It just had to, you know, kind of lump in more stuff and more feedback into all the stuff we already had to do.
So like what, I'm trying to get a sense of like a typical work day for you guys. Like what kind of hours are we talking here? Like when are you like eating and stuff like that? Like what?
Well, I mean, it must have been different for you, Andrew. You had a kid you were looking after.
Yeah, I can go into it after you.
Sure. I mean, my wife works early, so she'd get up at, 5:30 in the morning. So I got up at 5:30 with her, and since I just work from home, I'd walk over to my office and start work 5:30 a.m. And, breakfast, lunch, dinner, all at my desk, just working while I'm eating whatever, until, 11:30 at night. Would kind of pack it in, go to sleep, catch a few hours, and start it all the next day. And that was basically every day from January 1st till December, whatever it was, 15th, I don't know, almost a year, yeah.
And yeah.
I had a pretty similar experience. I would basically get up when my son got up at 6 in the morning-ish, and I'd watch him until he had his morning nap, and then I'd work for an hour, and then I'd watch him again until he went for his afternoon nap, work for another 2 hours or so. And then my wife would get home from work around 5-ish. We'd have dinner, put the kid to bed, and then she would watch him throughout the rest of the night if he got up. But then I would basically work from 6 p.m. around that time till about 2, 3 in the morning, maybe 4, 5, maybe all-nighters, depending on what builds we need to get out for Atlas. It always seemed to come around milestone time when I would basically just work all night just to get builds out.
Yeah.
The other problem that led to this thing is that we didn't have any QA. So I was basically the only one testing all the platforms. So not only am I trying to create all the builds to send to Atlas, because we didn't really have a great build process for that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I'm also trying to verify that they all work. So at like the 11th hour, people are checking stuff in. I'm trying to verify. I find problems. So at like 2 a.m. on a Sunday night, I'm like, whoa, Ryan, this is completely broken. We can't send this to Atlas. You need to fix this while I make these other three builds up.
Yeah.
So it was just a little crazy in that regard. And that is one thing that you don't necessarily get at like a 9-to-5 regular development job. I know sometimes it does happen, but
9-to-5 regular development job. I don't know if those exist.
I'm not familiar with that.
Those drink box guys do it.
That's true. Yeah.
Next Level does it pretty well too, I hear. So that was like my typical day where basically I sleep very little, but that only went on maybe for 3-4 months. I mean, still not a small amount of time, but
yeah,
it was pretty bad for a bit.
Well, yeah. And as I mentioned kind of before, is the trick was, not having the money to make sure, people were doing it. I mean, there's a time when, our animator like quit on us and, things would come up and it's like, well, we've got, to send Atlas a build in 2 weeks. Our animator just quit. Now what? And so it was always sort of a nightmare. Don't tell Atlas, I'm telling you, but the number of times we came like just razor thin sending them a build, it kept coming up. Yeah. Cause we just, didn't have, let's say the money and everything to hire a staff, couldn't build in any redundancies into the staff, right? The one animator quits.
It's don't not tell like Atlas on this publicly posted podcast.
Yeah.
So what happens if you don't deliver a build, basically? Because like that's something maybe people don't understand either. But like that's all built into your contract, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like technically, if we didn't send them a build, they were within their rights to say, that's it, we're done, we're out. Pay us back all the money we paid you. The deal's off. Which would have been bad because we didn't have the money to pay back. We had spent it on, the hardware and on artists and everything. So, that was a possibility. Thankfully, that did not happen. But yeah, that was sort of, if we, were not careful about getting everything ready to send them, that was always sort of a possibility.
There were some issues where certain builds crashed at certain points. So they, I think they technically failed the milestone for those, but they would say, okay, just, fix it up and get us a new one in a couple days. and will kind of waive it. So they're really lenient with this sort of like hard deadline. And they were understanding that we were a super small team and pretty limited on budget and just manpower. So they were really flexible with working with it and making sure that as long as we kept producing, you know, I guess a minimum, not a minimum, but, you know, a good amount of content.
They
were able to roll with the punches.
Overall, we did what we, I feel that we really surpassed what we contractually had to do in terms of, you know, content and stuff like that. So, and I think the final product, obviously they think it's great. So that worked out, but, it was a tough process for sure.
We had a pretty large scope in mind too, which is a big problem of almost every game. So that doesn't help. I think we cut a few areas.
It was funny actually how much stuff was cut. There was a lot cut. But there is a sense, I think, in which maybe Atlas didn't understand really the scope that we were making, even though, you know, I told them from day one, like, we're making a full RPG. It's a real game, you know? 40 cast, citizens to recruit. It's a full-fledged RPG. But I still think somehow in the back of their mind, they were expecting it to be like a short kind of indie game until at some point...
How many hours are we talking about for this game?
Well, I mean, I think, Andrew, your latest playthrough was 65 hours?
I don't think it was that high, but it was definitely in the 40 to 50 range.
Okay. What? I can't play this game. You guys realize
But hold on.
That was a 100% run, though.
Okay. That's the thing. So the game was developed. I have this mantra right from the very beginning. Was depth if you want it.
Yeah, I think we used broader, not longer.
Yeah, but that people misunderstood what that meant. So
yeah, I guess
I've changed it to depth if you want, which means there's a ton there if you want everything. And if not, you can hit the highlights and kind of just, you know, recruit, you know, as many or few citizens as you want. Don't do the optional stuff. And you can finish it much faster. And that was exactly for people who don't have a lot of time and just, you know, want to get in, get out, and get the gist of it and move on. So.
And I think we accomplished that. So
absolutely, yeah, for sure.
So, okay, I want to talk about sort of the marketing the game and sort of the final product. But before we do that, I just wanted to ask, I feel like this is a question that may be important also for people that are thinking about developing a game on their own, maybe. So you guys didn't, like, all the tools and stuff that you used, like, it was basically your own engine, like, everything was written yourself. Like, did you guys give any thought to, like, third-party engines or tools and things like that at all, or not really?
I don't think we gave much thought to it. I mean, like, the level editor we used was
third party.
Yeah, we didn't make that. But yeah, certainly we didn't really use any game engine. All the tools we wrote from scratch.
We didn't have a discussion about making the level editor ourselves, and I kind of said, okay, well, let me look at other options first, and then we found this one
that's
really fit in perfectly.
What's it called? Do you remember?
It's called Tiled.
Tiled. Yeah.
Yeah, and it. It was great, and it fit right in with everything we wanted to do. You can export stuff in XML.
Yeah, so that was
really
the thing,
easy
too.
To work with.
Yeah, we could write our own tools to sort of import the levels and, you know, do what we needed to do sort of offline to make them fit to our engine specifications, all that kind of stuff. So that worked out well. But yeah, I don't think, you know, like, we never really talked about using any. You know, there's a lot of, you know, game engines out there. Unity, RPG Maker, Game Maker. A whole bunch we could have used, but I think part of it was, you know, we had all the tech from Waveform, so we already had a base for, you know, rendering audio, a core structure that we could use. And then, you know, the stuff Andrew was making, we would have needed probably anyway in terms of, you know, just core stuff for the game. And, you know, once we had all that, we're like, well, we have so much code now that to throw it all away and go with another engine just seemed like a strange choice. So yeah, it kind of built up incrementally, I guess. Just, yeah, from Waveform and from what Andrew was working on and the old prototype we had, it just kind of snowballed one to the next to keep going with our own stuff.
Yeah, Ryan had a lot of base for, like, the core technology type stuff, like file loading, sound, localization, all that stuff. So I really, the stuff I brought to the table was object management, I would say, and, like, the platform encapsulating all the platform stuff, so it's much easier to use, and still, so, you know, you can call one function and it would just work on whatever platform. And I mean, the other disadvantage of going with an engine is then you have to try to optimize for all these consoles without really necessarily knowing how everything runs. Well, whereas since we wrote everything, we know how everything runs.
Yeah, and a big one too is, I mean, you know, Unity doesn't even support 3DS. So, you know, 3DS was a big important platform for us, especially in the early days talking to Atlas. They thought 3DS was an important one to hit. And if we told them, sorry, we're using Unity, can't do it, they may have just been like, all right, forget it. You know, if you can't hit a platform we think's important, that could have been the end of it.
Right.
So the fact that we, you know, could support anything we wanted was, I think, a pretty important factor.
I think the other thing we had going for us as an indie group and writing our own tech was that I come from like pretty technical code background. Ryan does as well, but has kind of shifted into design. So I feel like a lot of indie teams start with designers now, and we were starting with code as sort of our core back end. And a lot of indie teams don't have that sort of back end. They're struggling to find programmers. Mm-hmm. Whereas we had the programming down. We didn't have to hire, except we hired one guy to do some of the platform stuff. But
yeah,
that was all specialized. And now that it's done, there's really not much more. Like in our next game, there won't be too much that's needed on that stuff going forward. So a lot of guys, I think, struggle with that aspect of it, especially when you come to certification and you have to, you know, read technical documents to try to determine what's going on and what you need. I mean, I've been familiar with that stuff. I think Ryan did some work on that stuff before. Yeah. So we had that background already going for us, which can be like a pretty stressful process if you're not familiar with it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, again, just to be able to, you know, kind of take control of our own destiny kind of thing, you know, like back in January 2014, I think I was at the Steam Dev Days event and I was talking to some guy and he was shipping a game for PS4 in a couple months. And they were using Unity, but PS4 didn't support Unity yet, or Unity didn't support PS4, I should say. And they were just, you know, going on faith that, well, in a couple months when we get Unity, it'll just work and we can ship on PS4 the next month. Like, well, that I would not want to be in that boat and just having to hope something that I can't control works out. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting point you make also about, you know, that you guys come from a dev background. I think that, you know, as much as you hear, oh, hey, anybody can make a game now, there's lots of tools out there. I mean, it's true. But the fact that you guys were able to kind of stick it out and get this thing done, I mean, I know from experience, like the final days of a game, the programmers are just, it just happens that they're the ones who are there late getting things to work.
We and eat the just, shit. That's true. We
that's
eat
how
the
it,
shit.
It has to be. And that's the way it works. And yeah, so if you don't have somebody who's, you know, got the technical background and you're just kind of hoping that these tools will do it for you, well, the last minute you might be screwed. So
yeah,
it's unfortunate, but it's true. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I guess on the flip side, maybe one of the good things about some of the third party tools is maybe, you know, recruiting contractors and stuff, they'd be more familiar with certain things right off the bat and they'd know these things as opposed to maybe if there was any internal stuff that they had to learn. Mm-hmm. To work with you guys.
Well,
I don't know.
The one thing external tools have that we don't is actually we are lacking right now in a lot of our like tools in quotes. So, you know, level editor, we had to get somewhere, but like Unity provides really easy drag and drop functionality to do all this kind of stuff and put your lighting in and all that stuff. Our editor can't do 3D. Our editor can't really do great object sort of things, object manipulation. We kind of have to do it kind of manually. So there are still improvements to make to our process that you could probably get if you started with, you know, Unity. Mm. And Unity has that whole community about buying modules or components or whatever they're called,
right,
which can really help you out too. And you can buy stuff for pretty cheap that's pretty good. So when you're doing it all yourself, you don't really have anyone to call on in a jam or anything like that. And it is a time consuming process to develop the tech. So if you do what it's hard to say, but I think long run, multiple projects wise, we'll definitely be better off. But perhaps short term, single project wise, going with a third party engine probably gets you off the ground and probably even finished faster. Mm-hmm. You might have more problems at the end, but making the game would probably be a much smoother process.
Right. Or at least prototyping and just...
Definitely prototyping, yeah.
That kind of stuff, yeah.
I mean, there'll be an initial ramp up to learn it, but there's that with anything you need to learn.
Right. Yeah, you know, the thing too I like about doing it on your own is like, I feel like with any engine, because the way you learn it, you tend to learn it based on what it supports easily. You know, so I don't know. I like just having a blank slate. You know, like when I was working on Waveform, you know, the first thought was, well, I need to make wave manipulation fun. You know, and so I was like, well, I have a blank canvas here. I'm going to just code that up. Whereas I feel like, you know, if you are working in an engine like Unity or RPG Maker, you kind of just, I feel, tend to go with the flow of what that engine supports, what you're naturally able to do. And so, you know, I may have been like, well, this, you know, engine doesn't naturally support sine wave manipulation. I'm not going to bother with that game. You know, but just because I had a you know, empty canvas, it just, I feel like it, you know, sort of just fosters, I don't know, just, yeah, imagination. You can do anything you want. And that, I think, is important.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, so I guess in terms of the final product, you know, how are you guys happy with the way things came out? Like, was there anything that, you know, you would have liked to maybe have a little extra time with, or you would have liked to maybe do differently, or are you pretty much, this is the game we wanted to make?
You know, I mentioned like some things were cut that I think, you know, the game as
you're
it stands.
You're never done a game.
You're never done. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's, you're never done. There's always stuff you could do. And I think what we have now is honestly phenomenal. Every time I look at it, it blows my mind that we have made this game, you know, like with so much content, you know, whatever it is, 40, 50 hours, whatever it is, so many characters, you know, the animations look so good. You know, the music's amazing and it's on so many platforms. Like some days I can't even believe it. And I think in that sense, you know, coming from, you know, and building everything from scratch, like having this RPG match the design of, you know, all these recruitable citizens, like, It really is like exactly sort of what I wanted. I mean, Andrew, you can kind of maybe talk too, but I think it's amazing, and it really is very close to sort of how I envisioned it. Just, yeah, of course, minus all the things that, you know, could have gone in if we had infinite time. But like Andrew said, you're never done. There's always things you can add. But no, I think where we are now is really close to sort of where I wanted us to be.
Yeah, I think what worked out well is we kind of started with the core that was really solid, and then added all this other stuff, and then along the way kind of tweaked it. We never really had to do major hack removals of things that weren't working at all. That was the nice thing of kind of working in the 2D RPG Dragon Quest style battle system, is that it's pretty a well-known trail. So everyone's kind of familiar with it. We're familiar with it. The things we did differently were little tweaks, but not extreme changes. So we were pretty sure they'd work in our heads before we actually took the time to put them down in the game.
Well, and I think too, I mean, you know, Andrew knows my faults very well, I'm sure, as a developer, but one thing I'm really good at, having the code and design background, is I can iterate on things very quickly. So when we needed to make changes, I could, you know, design it and then implement it and kind of go back and forth really fast. So whenever there was things that needed to be changed, it tended to work pretty well. It didn't go through a whole, you know, committee process of handing it from this person to that person to this person to get it done. So I think that did help us, you know, when we needed change, especially Atlas would sometimes say, hey, we think this isn't working, fix it. You know, I was able to just sit down and be like, all right, I'll just, you know, fix it.
I like to consider our relationship a yin and yang relationship.
Yes.
We are opposites in many things, but work well together as a team.
Yeah, it's very true. It's very true. Yeah.
So here's a question that I've been thinking about a lot. How do indie games get noticed? Like, how do you get the word out there for your game? And obviously you talked a little bit about the Kickstarter, but I mean, your game's about to come out, or as you're hearing this, it is out. How do you get people to know about it?
Well, that's the big trick, isn't it? I don't think we did this well at all. But I think that was one of the advantages of going with Atlas, is they... Yeah. Have a name, they have the marketing contacts, like they have a press list that we don't have. So actually I just recently I was thinking about the same thing because, you know, we're at, you know, we're close to D-Day. We need to be getting the word out. We need people to see it. So I'm trying to figure out, like, is there anything I can do to kind of bring more visibility to the game? And I actually watched a GDC talk by one of my ex-coworkers, Chris McQuinn at Drinkbox, who did a talk from an indie perspective of marketing. And he was saying, like, hiring a PR firm is one of the best things you can do because they have their press list. They can, you know, they can have hard conversations that you don't want to have with people. And I feel like that was one of the big advantages of going with Atlas in the long run. I know I had some concerns about going with Atlas when we first were going to sign, and I hadn't really thought of this angle of it. And I think it's a really important angle because, you know, like, I don't know, like, I went on Steam the other day, and I looked in upcoming releases to see Citizens of Earth in there, and I think we were releasing in 6 days, and there had to be over 20 games releasing ahead of us. So it's just so saturated, the market, that you almost need someone like an Atlas or some PR firm or someone to sort of cut through just all the, not shovelware, but all the games that are coming out now. There's just so much content that you just need someone that'll be able to bring you up higher. And we've been lucky. I mean, getting a spot in that Nintendo Direct is huge. I mean, tons of people watch that Nintendo Direct. We haven't really had much in the way of Sony coverage, but maybe that
we were on their official PlayStation blog 2 days ago.
Yeah, we are. But, you know, I don't think we had a spot in their PlayStation Experience thing or anything. But, you know, getting that kind of stuff, getting in Nintendo's Nintendo Direct probably never would have happened if we were just some no-name indie. Unless we had a really amazing art style that could really draw people in. And as we were talking about before, it's pretty polarizing, apparently. So
I mean, I do think the art style is amazing.
I do too.
But, I still mind it, but yeah, well, you know, I
blame the YouTube compression rates. That's what I blame. No one's really seen the true HD yet. No one's seen it on a 60-inch TV on the PS4 or the Wii U.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Like at E3, we had people. They would see the game from afar, and they would run up and be like, "Wow, you know, this looks like Earthbound. This looks so cool." And like compared to internet comments, you know, in person, everyone was much more
positive.
Positive the game, right? But yeah, in terms of marketing, I mean, my opinion of it was, I think from day one, you know, I had this opinion and I shared it with the team that having Atlas's name on the game would do more for us than anything we could do on our own. And I do think that's true. You know, like Andrew said, I don't think we would have been a Nintendo Direct if it wasn't for Atlas. We wouldn't have been at E3 if it wasn't for Atlas. You know, we didn't have the press context Atlas has. You know, just their name is synonymous with RPGs. And I think, forget about all the other stuff they did for the game, you know, money and feedback and this and that. Just even just their name alone drew, I think, a lot of marketing and a lot of attention and a lot of sort of legitimacy for an RPG that I think we wouldn't have had otherwise.
And for us as a company.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, it's still a very tough problem. I mean, you know, how to, you know, get the, you know, big sites to notice you. I mean, you know, one thing is Andrew's always looking at IGN and Citizens of Earth is always like right at the top of their upcoming games lists. But IGN really hasn't done a lot of coverage for the game. And so it's like, well, you know, what do you got to do to get coverage?
How do you break that AAA shell?
Yeah, right? Like, because you're already on a site where all their fan base is eagerly anticipating our game, but we're still, you know, too small to really get the attention of the editors. You know what I mean? And so, what do you got to do? It's a tough one.
And we've tried to do our own marketing. We have like a Facebook page, facebook.com/citizensofearthgame, I think is the site. We have our own Twitter. And we have Ryan's Twitter handle too. And it just doesn't seem to, I mean, it's starting to pick up now as the game gets Steam, right? But in the early days, we were getting maybe like one new like a week, if that, even when press would cover the game, it just wasn't really getting enough coverage. People didn't seem to be interested. And apart from hitting all those social media avenues, I don't know how you can really force it into consumers' minds. You know, that's a mystery to me. other than having like press people cover it.
Yeah. I mean, like I kind of have a little bit of the perspective on the other side just because I, you know, write for Film Junk and, you know, I get people emailing me like, can you cover my indie film, blah, blah, blah. And like, I have to think, well, you know, and granted, like my site is, I'm only doing a few posts a day, so I'm pretty selective. And I just automatically think, well, nobody, like, I'm not just going to waste a post on some movie nobody's heard of because the readers aren't that interested in it. And unless I can make them interested in it, it's not worth it. And so then I think from your point of view, it's kind of the same problem. Like, how do you go to IGN and say, hey, you know, it's worth doing a post about our game?
We're really interesting.
Yeah. And they're thinking, yeah, but nobody's heard of you, so why should I write about you? Because people only want to read about the new Halo game or whatever. Yeah. And it's a catch-22, and I don't really know, other than, you know, doing things like, hey, we're kind of like Earthbound, so, hey, if you like Earthbound, maybe you'll like this. Giving people reference points helps, but it's not always going to work.
Yeah. So, yeah. Well, yeah, IGN is the weird one just because, like, we were so highly placed on their, like, you know, readers.
Buzz, almost.
Yeah, Buzz the list of games to come, so... That was just a weird sort of dichotomy where I think the readership would have wanted to see it just given the placement on their site. But in general, no, I totally know what you mean. Like most sites, obviously, that don't have those kind of lists. And yeah, how do you convince them that people want to hear about you? If I don't know.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess the other problem is, you know, because it's your development timeline was so kind of short and hectic. It's like, how do you guys have time to even think about marketing? You know, when you're like, you know, spending like 20 hours a day programming a game, like it's nuts.
You know, it's funny too, because like, I think early on I tried to do, you know, a couple of posts on Twitter and this and that about the game. But at some point, like when you're working 100 hours a week, like there's no room in my brain for, oh, what am I going to post on Twitter today? I'm just like, oh, got to get this done, you know? And it really kind of breaks down and it's really hard. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's, again, where maybe the publisher can help out a bit and have somebody, you know, having your back on that.
Yeah.
But actually, the other thing I was going to ask about, and you kind of mentioned this a little bit, but it seems like there's a lot of these indie game festival event type things, and they seem like they're pretty good at getting the word out about indie games as well.
Yeah, I think, now I don't know, but I think those kind of festivals are good, but for us... It was a problem, one, because I think at the time when we were like no publisher indie, we didn't really have the art that probably would have been necessary to really stand out at one of those events.
Right.
And then when we became publisher friendly indie, we're just so busy. We don't have time to prepare any sort of demo for an indie event. So, I mean,
and also, I don't think we even would have qualified because we had a publisher, right?
Yeah, maybe not. I don't know. I don't know. The indie title is so strange now.
Yeah. These
like, I mean,
weird.
I consider us indie because no one owns us, but it seems like other people don't consider us indie anymore because Atlas is behind us kind of thing. So, yeah. I don't know how it works anymore. It's this really gray area now. Of what
well,
indie
you know,
is.
So early on, though, we sent the game, or I sent the game, I don't know, to... some of those festivals like IGF and Indiecade. And we just got such weird feedback from them that I kind of just thought it was like, I think IGF, I can't remember how many judges got back. I think three, and two of them were like, oh, this game is really great. And one of them was like, for a political game, there's not enough politics. I'm like, well, it's not really a political game. It's a satire, you know? But he wanted like, you know, to introduce a bill in Congress, right? Like, and like, you know, what do you do? Like, I mean, you know, I'm just like, well, I don't think they get it. And so it's hard to, you know,
it's funny how that has kind of come back to bite us. We thought it would be hilarious that you play as the vice president of the world and he literally does nothing.
Yeah.
And people seem confused, like, oh, this game's about politics. I don't want to play a game about politics.
Yeah,
meanwhile, we have literally nothing about politics other than originally saying you just won an election.
Yeah.
And you go to the Capitol building. Like there's literally nothing else about politics in this game. So it's kind of funny that no one's really taken the time to inquire what aspect of politics are in the game. They just kind of make the assumptions, which is another thing that maybe hurt us in our original Kickstarter pitch.
Maybe. I mean, the one thing I will say, too, is when we were first talking about the game, every time we told people, you play as the vice president of the world, they're like, whoa, that's pretty funny. And I think, you know, having that as your character does kind of interest people. You know, it's unique, right? So there's pros and cons, I think, to it. But
yeah. Right.
Well, kind of like the Earthbound tie, you know?
Yeah,
people hate it or love it, so apparently we can't win either way.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, only other question I've got is like, what's next for you guys? You guys have something in the works already that you're talking about, or are you going to take some time and relax, or what?
Well, I mean, I think we, you know, everyone's sort of decompressing a bit. Obviously the team has diminished a lot from its original peak since, you know, not everyone needs to be working so much since the game's about to ship, but you know, yeah, we are talking about future pitches. And right now, Andrew and I are doing a lot of work kind of consolidating the tech from Citizens and kind of plugging some gaps in terms of what we want for a foundation for the next project. So that's going pretty well. And, you know, we're talking with Atlas and some other, you know, publishers about, you know, future projects. So, yeah, we've got quite a few things sort of on the go in terms of ideas. And, you know, it's kind of this tech work that we're doing and publisher interest. So, yeah, we've got some plans.
A lot of promising, I think, and I think, well, I mean, we need to wait to see how Citizens does, I think, as well, because, well, we're running out of money. We're out of money.
Suffice to say, if Citizens of Earth doesn't, you know, make us, you know, a reasonable amount of money, my wife will literally kill me if I do a third game for like no pay. You know what I mean? So that's a factor.
Yeah. Might have to go do some contract work or something for a bit.
Yeah.
Okay. I was going to ask something else, but I forget now. Oh, well, I guess just, so what are all the platforms again? And I don't know if we've mentioned how much the game costs.
No, I haven't. I can take this.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, releasing January 20th, in case this comes out early or late, it's actually 20th in most regions, 21st for Sony Europe, 22nd for Nintendo Europe, and all the other North Americans are the 20th. And so PC, PS4, Vita, Wii U, 3DS, price point in North America is $14.99, and it is €11.99 in Europe, and I'm not sure of the conversion in Australian dollars, but it'll be something similar to whatever that price conversion is. Also, for the first week, it's actually on sale, 20% off everywhere. If you're a PS Plus member, that sale is actually 2 weeks long. And if you live in Europe and are planning on buying it on the Wii U and or 3DS, if you buy one of them, you can get the other one at 60% off.
I thought it was 40. Is it 60?
40% off? It might be 40% off.
I think it was 40, but it's a good discount.
Either way, a deal if you want to buy two.
Yeah. And it's a digital release, right? So on the
digital,
you know,
only.
Steam,
that's right.
And the PlayStation Network and the eShop.
eShop.
Nintendo, so.
So look for it there.
Cool.
Yep.
All right.
I think that's it. I think I hit all territories. And
I think you got it. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about a few other things then before we wrap this up. Why don't we get into this hot button topic that we kind of hinted at earlier?
Let's dive in.
Now, I feel like we did cover this on an episode like a year or two ago, because I know we talked about
the day one patches aspect.
Well, we talked about bugs that break a game essentially, and you know what issues result from that, and you know should games be released in that kind of state. But it kind of came to a whole nother level over, you know, the holiday season, because both Assassin's Creed Unity and the Halo Master Chief Collection were released, and you know, two of the biggest games for the holiday season, and both of them were, according to a lot of people, nearly unplayable. And you know, they had day one patches for both, I believe. And continued to work feverishly to get more and more patches.
And I just remembered Drive Club as well.
Oh, that's right.
also came out very broken.
This was, and I mean, there was already not a ton of big games coming out this holiday season. A lot of stuff got delayed. And then when these big games come out and they have like, they're just riddled with bugs and stuff, people are complaining. It's a bit of a problem. And, you know, it's to the point where Joystick announced this week they're not doing scores for their reviews anymore, partially because of this issue. Because it's like when a game is released,
it's no longer done.
It's not done. How do you put a score rating on something that, you know, is going to be patched and fixed? And it's true. And I mean, like, you might test a game in a totally different environment, you know, in a beta environment or something, and then the game actually gets released to the public, and then the servers just get crushed, and it's completely different.
Yeah, multiplayer is a whole nother beast. So, like, especially for these huge games, how do you, I don't know how you test them, but I mean, I haven't played Drive Club or Halo Chief, but I played a little bit of Assassin's Creed Unity, and I didn't try the multiplayer, but even the single player game had really big flaws, and I had played it a few weeks after it come out with patches, and it still had like design problems and bugs that didn't let me start quests and things like that. So that kind of thing is strange to me, because just having to go through this whole QA process with Sony and Nintendo, it's almost amazing that a game like that passes certification.
Yeah.
Knowing what I know now of being like deep in the certification process.
Yeah.
Because like some of the stuff is just like we got dinged on stuff that's so obscure.
Yeah.
That we had to fix.
Sony's QA was very thorough.
Very good. So to believe that a lot of these AC Unity bugs got through is highly unlikely. Most likely Ubisoft said, how about you just let it through? And we're going to keep putting a ton of games on your platform, and they're going to sell lots. Mm. So I'm sure there's something like that that goes on behind the scenes. But just from what I know, it's pretty remarkable that Sony would actually let this slide, just because it feels like they're trying to keep up a quality level on their platform and didn't. And I think the Master Chief one was a little different, because I think that was just kind of the multiplayer. I think the other aspects of that game were fine, if I recall.
That is mostly what I've heard. But I guess, you know, the thing with the Microsoft, I mean, you're talking about, you know, Ubisoft going to, you know, whoever is, whatever platform the game's coming out on, saying, hey, can you maybe give us a little bit of a pass here? This is going to be a system seller. I mean, that is definitely the case with the Halo Master Chief Collection, because it's a Microsoft game.
Yeah.
They know they needed that out for the holiday season.
Yeah.
And if they knew there were problems, they probably said, we don't have a choice. This has to go out.
Yeah.
But the thing is, did it hurt them? Will it hurt them? I don't know. Like, I mean, from what I understand, it's still not 100%. I don't know if it's playable at this point, the multiplayer stuff, but it's still got problems.
Yeah.
And, I mean, will these companies see repercussions to this, or will this just continue happening, and, you know, who cares?
Yeah, I wonder go ahead, Ryan.
Oh, I was going to say, you know, having obviously, you know, gone through both sides of it, right? You know, as a developer and as a consumer, you know, I can sort of see both sides. I mean, like, it does suck, of course, if you spend, you know, $70 on a game and you can't play it. Obviously, that is a horrible user experience. But from the other side, too, I mean, like, making a game is hard. You know what I mean? And like, it's just, especially hitting deadlines and stuff, like,
yeah, and
I do have sympathy for, you know, developers like having to chip a game as bug-free as possible. Like, it's not easy.
Especially the multiplayer ones.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, these games are just getting more and more complex.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
You know, these next-gen games, like, it's just, like, crazy. And like, you know, the number of people working on these huge games just keeps going up.
Yeah.
And I mean, you can't just throw more people at it and assume that that fixes it, because then the complexity of managing the team gets higher, and like, it's just nuts. So it kind of feels like we're at this like weird saturation point now, where, you know, the games are a little too big to fully manage and keep within scope, and especially something like Assassin's Creed, where they're trying to release one every year. Like, that is really hard to do.
I think it might not be that the games are too big. I think that they're trying to force deadlines before a game's done. And with the Master Chief one, maybe you could add a bigger tester pool to simulate that, but I don't know. That could be something that could be really hard to find, even with a large testing pool. That might be something that only comes up when it's in the wild. Whereas the Assassin's Creed thing, I think that was just, that game wasn't ready for multiple reasons.
I mean, but I think there's something about the idea that games are getting more complex and bigger. I mean, even just like Citizens of Earth, like we have so many, like every citizen has their own talent that they can use. Like it's a whole new feature per citizen. And, you know, of course that was a whole bunch of new bugs. Sometimes, you know, different platforms had, you know, different bugs with each one. Like there was a lot there. And you just kind of think back to, you know, games on the, you know, Nintendo, Super Nintendo, like just having so much, you know, many fewer features and things like that. Like, I think that helps when they're like, all right, we're manufacturing this, we're done. There's no patch, right? Whereas, you know, as soon as you start adding tons of stuff and adding more possibility for bugs, like, you get into a weird area where you, I don't know, it's hard.
I wonder if, so the thing, I think coding styles have changed from that day too. I think back in the SNES days, you basically like threw out everything you did and started fresh for every game. And I think now there's more of an emphasis on having modular pieces that you can kind of take with you to the next project. I know that's how we kind of coded the tech behind Citizens. So I think what happens is when you have these like 1,000-man teams, maybe probably a team of like 40 coders or something, when you have all these hands in the pot stirring it up and you're using that code base as your base as you go along, I mean, this is what the seventh Assassin's Creed game or something, like there's quite a few now. And really when you go to the next gen, ideally they'd only have to update certain of these modules. You wouldn't have to rewrite the entire code base, so most of the stuff would be able to reuse. But when you have so many people messing around in there, I imagine that there are bugs in there that are just so hard to find now, because unless they have perfect documentation and, you know, perfect code review process and, you know, everyone knows it front and back, I guarantee there's stuff now in there that's just so obscure. And there's like, if you do this, then that, something bad, really bad happens. And that's going to be so hard to find. And I think probably games are getting to that point as well, where just the underlying tech has just been so, I wouldn't say muddled, but maybe just so manipulated. And maybe, you know, people did something they didn't quite understand. It wasn't quite right. And I think that might be leading to some of this stuff too.
Well, I think that is kind of the problem with the Halo Master Chief Collection too. Because I know a lot of people think, well, what the hell? Like, these games have already shipped on other platforms. Like, why isn't this working? But the problem is they're essentially porting it to a new platform. But from what I understand, the problem is like a lot of those games were made to work with like an older version of Xbox Live. Now they have to work with the new Xbox Live on Xbox One, and it's kind of different. And like all that stuff just broke.
Yeah, and I think the Bungie guys were really smart guys. So they probably had a lot of little undocumented little optimizations that probably made it run awesome. That maybe might have been overlooked when 343 took over.
Yeah, and, that's possible.
And even like now with the cloud, right? I'm sure they're using the cloud. So maybe there was some, you know, overlook things when they kind of transitioned to using some of that tech as well. But I mean, that's just all speculation. Who knows?
I mean, I guess the other issue with these day one patches is the whole process of buying a new game now is kind of a pain in the ass, because you go to the store, you buy a game, or maybe you download it, whatever. But you think you're ready to play this game, and then you pop it in, and it's like, oh, now I got to download this giant patch and wait for that to install.
Well, you also have to install the game,
right?
Then install the patch, then maybe get another patch on top of that patch.
Yeah, so like it is getting more and more frustrating for the gamer.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I guess, you know, with a lot of these situations, they're trying to make it up to people saying, hey, you get a free couple months of Xbox Live or a
really cheap Xbox One. Didn't you take advantage of that?
I did. We'll get to that. But I mean, like, do you guys think that stuff makes up for it? Like, I don't know if you guys have a sense. Like, I know our friend Andrew James, who's a Film Junk listener and does his own podcast over at Row 3. He sent out an email, I believe, today. He was a huge Halo fan, and he'd been complaining about how the Master Chief Collection wasn't working for him. Sent out an email today saying, sold my Xbox One, went PS4.
Oh, right. Really?
Yeah. So it's like, how many people are doing that? Like, if that's what you bought an Xbox One for and that game is still not working, mm-hmm. are people yeah. just going to say, fuck it, I'm out? Like,
yeah, I mean, that's two maybe. Months, right? So it's a long time to wait for a game that's technically retail, like ready to be played. So,
I mean, I do think, you know, people are pretty forgiving if you kind of meet them halfway, right? You know, if you're like, hey, sorry about that. Yeah, here's free Xbox Live. Here's some free whatever. I mean, I think that does go a long way to kind of mend the difficulty. But at the same time, if you bought the system for one game and it doesn't work, I mean, that's you're putting a lot of investment into one product. And if it doesn't work, Microsoft would have to do a lot to kind of win back that person, as opposed to if it was just like, oh, well, I already own this platform. I'm going to pick up the new Assassin's Creed. You probably don't have as much invested in it as a consumer, you know?
Yeah. Well, and I think that's why the Halo thing is a big deal. I mean, we didn't talk about this news story, but in November, Xbox One, apparently for the first time, the sales surpassed the PS4 sales. And a big part of that was they had some great Black Friday sales and stuff like that. But also the Halo Master Chief Collection came out, and a lot of people, you know, are
pick that up.
Yeah, a lot of people who are Xbox diehards, they only play Halo. That's all they play. And when the new Halo came out for Xbox One, they said, okay, we're making the switch. And they did it, and that game wasn't working for them. So
yeah.
I don't know. It's definitely not a good situation. Just in general, like when you look at the game industry, like that kind of stuff is frustrating people, and it's you know, a bad reputation for the industry as a whole to have, I think.
Yeah. Well, I think it too, you know, I guess there's a difference between, you know, this game is unplayable, where's the patch? And, you know, this game's got some, you know, rough around the edges.
Right.
You know, and, you know, you get a day one patch. I mean, yeah, there's definitely a bit of a different, if you can still play it, I think maybe you're a bit more forgiving as opposed to, well, this entire, you know, multiplayer mode doesn't work. Well, I mean, yeah, that starts to get a little more problematic too.
Yeah, and again, like, that's a lot of people only buy Halo for the multiplayer. They don't even play the single player campaign, so.
Yeah.
It will be interesting, going back to the joystick part of this, that if this becomes a trend, and so I mean, Metacritic is not perfect, but I think it has its place. You know, you kind of get a feel for a game based on its Metacritic score. And if people start abandoning scores wholesale, especially the higher end, more respected sites, it could either really skew Metacritic in a weird way, or it may make Metacritic obsolete, which will be even stranger to not be able to sort of have this sort of like very tangible number that represents what a game is. I think it'll be a lot harder for consumers to make decisions if everyone abandons their review score. I mean, that being said, review scores can really damage a game also. Mm-hmm. So maybe a pure verbal description will be better at describing a game that might have got, let's say, a 5 out of 10. And maybe it will still convince some people to buy it or whatever. But I don't know if I totally agree of getting rid of the review score. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, I'm very interested to see what happens with this. Because, I mean, Joystick isn't the first site to do this, because Kotaku has been doing this for a while.
Yeah.
They have a system where it basically says, should I play this game? And I think the options are yes, not yet, no, and there might be one other one in there. Mm-hmm. So the not yet could be applied to, you know, the game that's good but has issues that might be patched or whatever. So you still got IGN and GameSpot, which are kind of the two major game sites, and they still have scores. And a lot of people like scores. A lot of people just want to know a number. Is it good? Should I get it? But I personally, I think it's kind of bad for for the game industry in a lot of ways, because people are so reliant on that. They will never take a chance on something that's, you know, slightly below 90%, you know, like, because then it's not good. But there's like, there is some subjective elements to that. And I don't know, it's not fair.
You know what I've kind of found is an interesting alternative. You know, Rotten Tomatoes is basically like, you either like it or don't like it. And then they kind of, your percentage score is like the percentage of people that like it.
Right.
There's no real number. Like, you know, people aren't saying, well, this got 7 out of 10. It's just like, they like it. That's one more for the yes pile. And, you know, there's something to that as well, I think, in the sense of like, really, you're just saying, you know, someone's saying, yeah, you know what, it's worth your money to see it, or it's not. And that has some interesting alternative to Metacritic, because, you know, what's the difference between a 7 and a 6.5 and a 7.5? Like, who knows? You know what I mean? It's so variable. So I think looking at how many people liked it, and if you care, you can read their full review and be like, oh, they liked it, but they recommend it's only good for people who really like action genre. Well, maybe it's not for me then. And you kind of get like a really quick high-level synopsis, but also the option to kind of go in a bit deeper. And I mean, we kind of have that now with review scores. I mean, you can read the whole review if you want and get the details, but I don't know, maybe most people don't. So maybe a like it, don't like it is a better, just real quick metric, as opposed to assigning a number with such a huge spectrum.
That's actually a good point, because I know when I'm scouring the internet looking for anything and everything, Citizens of Earth, to see what people are thinking, if I find a YouTube thing, I always look at the, I call it the like-hate ratio.
Yeah.
Or the yes-no, like how many people have up-thumbed it and how many have down-thumbed it. And I use that as a guideline, as sort of like, just to see. It's almost the, well, it is the exact same thing. It's the Rotten Tomatoes score, essentially. And I do get more out of that, because a lot more people are willing to just say, just a quick yes vote, than like writing up something, or like en masse, I mean, than writing a comment in below. Most likely the comments are only people who are one of the extremes. They're not any of the people in the middle. So I find with the common stuff, you always have to take it with a grain of salt. But the yes, no, I feel like maybe is a little more accurate to maybe the actual feeling of the game. And like the number of people that see it are also important too. So yeah, I think a Rotten Tomatoes type approach would probably be better than the current score.
Yeah, I mean, I think about this a lot, because you know, obviously we talk about review scores for movies and stuff a lot on Film Junk, and the thing is, I feel like with movies there is still this feeling that a lot of people will see review scores and they'll be like, "Ah, it's the critics. Who gives a shit? Like, I'll still go see this," you know. But with games, it's a little different. Like, people really take the review scores seriously, and they base their buying on it like almost 100%. It's like if that game got a bad review score, there's no way I'm going to buy it. I kind of wish there was a little less reliance on that, and I don't know, I guess maybe forcing people to read the full review would be a good thing, but I don't know, a site like IGN, like, they know people just want that number. If they got rid of that, their readership would probably drop.
Well, they had a big enough fallout when they went to just 0.5 increments.
Really?
Because they used to do any number, right? But then I think now they just do like 0.5, like, so there's no 9.3, it's either 9 or 9.5.
Oh, okay.
If I recall, and I feel like people got pretty, you know, up in arms about that change, let alone getting review scores altogether.
I think I remembered a similar outcry when X-Play, Adam Sessler's old show, went from 5 to 4 stars.
Oh, yeah.
I think people freaked out about that also.
Yeah.
Which I guess is, I don't know, it's mind-boggling to me, but I guess...
Yeah, well...
I don't know why people care so much.
I'll tell you, here's my big thing on review scores. There's a game on the GameCube called Geist. This is like one of my favorite games of all time now. I thought it was so innovative. IGN gave it 7 point whatever. I didn't buy it. Until years later, I found it like for cheap, $15 somewhere. I picked it up, and I thought, this is amazing. I can't believe I didn't buy it. And the fact that, you know, I almost missed out on something because it was a 7 point whatever that ended up being one of my favorite games is, you know, crazy. And I wonder how many, you know, games that happens to, how many people that happens to when, like you said, I mean, if it's below a 9, it's like, ah, whatever, forget it. You know what I mean? So.
All right. So looks like we lost Ryan due to some internet connection difficulties. And we're just going to have to say goodbye and thanks for being on the show, Ryan. But we'll continue on and we'll wrap things up pretty quickly. I think the hot button discussion was mostly
wrapped.
Yeah. So
he did have he was going on a good rant there about how the review score can really negatively impact buying, even if it's an even mediocre score. Some people will see like a value under 8, they're not touching. Meanwhile, if that's your type of game, that could be perfect for you. Actually, I did think of something. What if sites almost had 2 reviews? Now, they probably won't do this just for monetary reasons, but let's say you're releasing an RPG. Let's have a review written by a guy who loves RPGs. Like, this guy most likely is going to give it a high score. And then you have someone who is either moderately familiar with RPGs or the genre, whatever genre it is, or even, like, has never played an RPG, have a review. Now, that will become, obviously, harder to find that person as, like, they work there longer.
Right.
But it might give a neat take on the review score. I think I've seen other outlets do sort of like the second take idea where they have one primary reviewer and then other people kind of chime in.
Yeah.
Just kind of like the idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good idea, but again, it's kind of like I think in those cases there's still only one main score
for
the overall thing. So yeah. It would be better if every second and third take had their own score as well.
Yeah. But then Metacritic might get mad because then they're like averaging this like 10 and then an 8 and a 6 together to make an 8 or whatever. I don't know. It might just not work out well, but just an idea. Throwing it out there.
Yeah. All right. Well, so it wouldn't be a Game Junk podcast without us talking about some of the games we've been playing. And it has been a few months since the last episode, so I'm sure there's been some stuff worth talking about. And we'll try and save, I mean, I think there's a few things that Frank also played, so we'll try and save some of those discussions for when he's back. But in the meantime, you got anything you want to talk about briefly?
Yeah, well, I've, in my sort of post Citizens of Earth downtime, sort of like the depression of not having anything to do almost.
Right.
It's almost like when you finish the season of a sport and there's kind of that letdown where you've been going to practice for like 4 months. Every day you're all like gung-ho to go. And then the first day you don't do it, your life almost feels like it's missing something. I don't know if you've experienced that before, but that's how it feels right now. In that sort of lack of what am I working on kind of thing.
Right.
So I filled that with playing a shit ton of games.
Nice.
So I've been playing a lot of stuff kind of to get ready for a sort of like 2014 wrap-up show. So I won't go into any of that, but I'll talk about some of the older stuff I played. I beat The Swapper, which I know, Dwyer, you were saying you played through and really enjoyed. I really enjoyed it as well. The swapping mechanic and the puzzles, I thought they pulled off perfectly. There's a few puzzles, maybe 3 or 4, where I was like, I have no idea. I'm going to YouTube this and use YouTube to solve it, mainly because I didn't want to put in like 2 hours into a single puzzle. I just kind of wanted to move on.
Mm-hmm.
I actually played Resident Evil 4. I was like, I need to play this game at least once. And I think I'm about halfway through, so I've not really gotten through it. But that game still holds up today, even with the sort of like tank controls and that. So I was surprised at how well it held up, even but through.
Resident Evil 4, does it have tank controls? I'm trying to remember now. I mean, it's not really tank
It's not like
controls.
As bad.
It's just...
Well, it's kind of like that over-the-shoulder cam, I guess.
Yeah,
not
right.
really tank. But you can't, like, turn your guy 360. It kind of moves the camera with it.
Right, yeah.
And there is, I think there... Oh, maybe not. I was thinking there are some fixed camera positions, but maybe not. But regardless, really enjoying the bosses in that. Really enjoying the atmosphere of that game. There was like, it really took some different twists I wasn't expecting. And yeah, surprised at how much I'm enjoying it. I got into Skyrim again, played a bunch more of that. That game, I have no idea when that game is going to end. But still really liking it. I picked up Star Trek game on Steam this time. I think I had played it before on my PS3. And I think I talked about it on a previous show where I got really frustrated with a lot of things about it. So I don't know if it was the fact that it was patched or that I was playing on easy, but I really enjoyed this game a lot more this time. And For any Star Trek fan, I would say go play it because it really captures the like J.J. Abrams feel. Also made by Digital Extremes in London, Ontario, so Canadian people should support a local Canadian indie developer. And yeah,
they also did that Warframe game.
Yeah,
right?
Warframe right now is their big title.
Yeah, I think that's there's free. Some people at my work that are into that. So
it's gotten surprisingly big. Actually, I think they got bought by some Chinese or Japanese company, or at least a large percentage of their shareholders or shares were purchased by another company because that game is doing so well.
Cool.
And then the last thing I played that I'll talk about that's kind of older is Beyond Two Souls. I finally got around to playing that. I'm about 3/4 of the way through it now, and as you may have guessed, I'm loving every second of it.
Wow.
I don't know how.
Well, now wait a minute. Heavy Rain, was that your
loved
number
it.
One of
it would have been up
whatever
there.
Year? I think yeah. It was like, yeah.
I love that sort of just like storytelling aspect of a game. I don't care if it's like holding your hand through something. The one thing that's different about this game than Heavy Rain is that this game, I definitely feel like the moment-to-moment decisions you make are not really impactful on the overall story. It's kind of just more of like your experience of Jody's experience at that time. And it'll get to the end regardless of what you choose to do. Whereas in Heavy Rain, there was tons of branching story arcs and the game could end in any number of ways. But overall, the mechanics I'm really liking. Did you play it at all, Sean?
No, I wanted to check it out. So this is the one with Ellen Page.
Yeah, Ellen Page, yeah.
And so was there another actor who's in it as well?
Oh yeah, Willem Dafoe.
Willem Dafoe, right, okay.
And so their performances are awesome. There are like some really tense moments in the game. They really do a good job of sort of like capturing horror within the game. And I think other games like Resident Evil do it as well, but it kind of loses its purpose when you're kind of immersed in horror for so long, whereas this game only has like small sections. So every time you come to one, it's pretty riveting, I find. And they've improved the Heavy Rain mechanic aspects of it. They added this kind of like an action quick time system, but instead of like looking for a button to press like X, circle, square, whatever, you have to flick the right joystick in the direction that Ellen Page is moving her body. So she's like throwing a punch in camera space from right to left. You have to hit left on the right thumbstick. That makes sense.
Okay.
So you kind of like move with her on screen. So that feels right, but there are definitely some times where it's a little too quick and I can't really tell what direction they want me to press and I get things wrong, which is not a bad thing. I don't think I've ever failed anything. Although there was one section where I got trapped in a burning building and apparently you can get out of that if you do the QuickTime stuff correctly, and I did not. So that was one of the examples where obviously the story is not greatly impacted by your decisions or what you get wrong or right.
Okay.
But it's kind of neat that they have sort of like different details as you go through. The other thing I think they pull off well is the story is not just a straight line. They have like a storyline from when she was a young kid to the end of the story. And they sort of jump along the timeline in a seemingly random order and tell like little snippets of her life at different points in time. And so they're kind of alluding that there's these creatures, spiritual things around. And then kind of they jump over to like another part where she's in the CIA. And then they jump back to when she's a kid. And it all seems random, but they do a good job. There's so many like open vistas and neat set piece environments that I'm never bored as I'm playing it and just really enjoying it. This probably would have been one of my top games. And I think it didn't receive very good review scores since we're just talking about review scores. But I really like it. I would rate it really high and I borrowed it from the old library. So everyone should go look in their library.
It's the best place to get games.
That's right.
So, but you did get a PS4 finally.
I did, yes. Yes, I am next gen. Nice. Finally. Yeah, so I've been borrowing a lot of library games. Actually, I can talk about Killzone Shadowfall as well, which I played, which is an older game. And I absolutely love that game. I don't know how that... I mean, that game was reviewed well, I think. But I don't think... I think it only got like eights or so.
Yeah, it was... I mean, I think most people just kind of said the visuals were nice, but it was just a very generic shooter. And I haven't played very much of it, so I can't give you my own opinion on it. But
yeah, I beat it. I loved it. I would have given it 5 out of 5 or whatever we rate on this show. But the graphics are literally the best looking next-gen game I've seen. And I mean, I played Alien Isolation recently, which is a newer game, and Killzone blows that game out of the water. I haven't played like Shadow of Mordor yet, which I want to for the next show, which probably is going to be up there as well. But this, I don't know, there's just something about all the fine detail and all the environments. You go in grates and you can see little piles of dirt. The lighting is just insane. They do a lot of like environmental light with the sun and everything. It's just incredible. It looks incredible. Everything, they pull off fog, they pull out, I don't know, just is incredible. I would love to see a like third person action adventure game set in that engine with it looking that good, because I think that game, like the guys at Guerrilla, just know how to make something look really, but really pretty on screen.
Is the fact that it's a first person shooter why they are able to pull some of that off? Because, you know, generally you don't have to worry about animations and things on your main character, and you can focus a little more on environments and stuff.
Maybe, but the enemies and things aren't, they don't seem to cheap out on the animation there. So although you do, you may run into some fidgety stuff on like a main character jumping over something. I feel that even adding a main character, even just, not even if Guerrilla did it, just if anyone took this engine and did the lighting like these guys do, I don't know, or and just stole all their environment artists and just said, come over here and make this game look awesome, because they know what they're doing, those guys. So the effects, visual guys, lighting guys, they're all really good at what they do. Probably, I don't know, it'll be hard to surpass that as far as visual quality, I think.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what other next-gen games I've seen that look better or that I've heard have looked better. I mean, I know Rise on Xbox One was pretty impressive when we saw that at Frank's place.
Yeah.
I played a lot of it, but...
Yeah, it's hard for me to remember, but yeah, that game did look good as well. I think maybe just... I know there was a lot of moments in Killzone where you're in like a tight confined space and it just looks absolutely gorgeous. And yeah, be tough to beat. I'll try to think of some, but I can't right now. Maybe Frank can on the next show.
Okay. So I also picked up a new console, as I kind of mentioned, with the Black Friday sales for the Xbox One. You know, Frank was just like texting me nonstop, like all day, just like, dude, you got to pick it up. This is a great deal. You got to pick it up. It's a great deal. And eventually I realized he was kind of right. And I think the thing that put me over the edge is I thought,
Master Chief Collection.
No, I mean, the game that sold me on it, I really wanted Sunset Overdrive, even though it was actually on sale elsewhere. I chose that as my free game. That came with the it was the Assassin's Creed Unity bundle, but I haven't played Unity yet.
Well, you're not losing it.
But I mean, I'm loving Sunset Overdrive, actually. Like, I won't go too much into it, but it's for anybody who it's kind of a nonsensical game, but it's got a great sense of humor. The basic mechanics that they're mixing, it's kind of like Tony Hawk meets Left 4 Dead. I don't know what else I would throw in there, but it's just like...
Like shooter platformer type thing, almost.
It's a shooter, but like you're grinding on like rails and stuff like jumping really high.
I've heard it compared to Jet Grind Radio.
Jet Grind Radio, yeah, that makes sense. But and the thing is, like, it's never explained like why you're able to grind on all this stuff. Like, there's no explanation for it, but it's just fun. Like, that's, you know, that was their primary concern in designing the game, was just like, let's take all these elements from other games that are fun and just do it. And it's, yeah, like I said, it has a sense of humor, so that kind of works for it. Like, there's sort of this story about, you know, I guess people have kind of turned into these mutant zombie type things from an energy drink. So it's like an energy drink, and it's kind of this whole like anti-corporation, anti-consumerism kind of vibe, but it's very tongue-in-cheek. Yeah, I'm really liking that. But what was I going to say about the Xbox One? Oh, so the thing that kind of made me decide to get it, even though you can buy it now without the Kinect, and it's $100 cheaper,
yep.
I thought, well, like, my son is kind of, Kieran's kind of getting into video games a little bit, and I kind of thought with the Kinect, that might be something that he could get into.
Just buy the Happy Action Theater or whatever that, or is that on 360?
I think a lot of the, like, that's the thing, there's not a ton of kids Kinect games for the Xbox One yet, but it came with Dance Central Spotlight, which is sort of their stripped down version of Dance Central, and we've had a bit of fun with that, but it's the catalog, like, it's basically just a shell so you can buy stuff from their store, and the selection in the store is not great.
No.
At least not for me. I mean, I imagine there's lots of people who love the songs that are in there, but not enough of the stuff I like.
It'll be interesting to see if anyone really takes the time to develop for that anymore, because they had this big push on almost getting rid of it, and now it's not mandatory.
The Kinect,
yeah. So I wonder if you will see many titles, like maybe from Microsoft first party, but I don't know if you'd see any third party developers, maybe Ubisoft.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I still feel like there's some interesting stuff that could be done there. And I know there's that game Dark Dreams Don't Die. I don't know if you've heard of it.
No.
But it's free if you have Xbox Live Gold or whatever this month. And I'm really planning on checking it out, because it seems kind of like a Heavy Rain kind of detective kind of story, but like where you search things like by using like motions with the Kinect and stuff.
Love it.
And it sounds really cheesy, but really fun. So I'm going to check that out soon. But yeah, so that's all I've really been playing for Xbox so far. But other stuff I can mention. Oh, so as far as getting into games with Kieran, Captain Toad Treasure Tracker.
Yeah, good.
Freaking loves that game.
Yeah.
And gave me an excuse to be able to play it with him.
Yeah, that's perfect.
And yeah, we beat the game, and it's
what?
Actually
you beat a game.
I beat a few games over the past few months, but I won't talk about all of them right now. But yeah, it's I mean, it is exactly what you'd expect for the most part. It's just taking those little levels from Super Mario 3D World and giving it its own thing. But it's actually like there's some pretty clever designs and some pretty clever puzzles. And, yeah, it's something kind of original and fresh, even though it is, you know, a spinoff from Super Mario Brothers. It's kind of Nintendo doing what they do best, just sort of taking an idea and running with it. And, you know, the only downside to it, I would say, is that some of the cutscenes, like, there's a little bit of a story they try to tell, but essentially there's three chapters to the game, and each chapter you kind of get the same cutscenes over and over again.
Oh, I see.
And it's just like, it feels very cheap and generic, but it was a budget priced game as well. So
yeah, wasn't it $40 instead of $60 or
I think
something
so,
like
yeah.
that? Yeah.
A couple other things. I think I mentioned, like, not last show, the show before that, we were talking about puzzle games, and one of you guys said I should check out Professor Layton. Do you remember
yes.
this?
Yes.
So I finally picked up Professor Layton and the Unwound Future.
Excellent.
And I've been playing a fair amount of that and really enjoying it.
I thought you would. It's like they have a lot of math puzzles and other kind of like object puzzles that I thought would be right up your alley.
Yeah, I mean, it the puzzles are awesome. And the story in this particular game, like, I mean, I feel like this is one of the better reviewed Professor Layton games. I don't know for sure. But there's enough of an interesting story that, you know, it's not literally just like a Brain Age thing where you just present it with puzzle after puzzle. Like, there's still something kind of tying it all together that I'm kind of digging.
I played one that was kind of, I kind of got the feeling of that, something with a tower. And I kind of felt like I was just kind of running between puzzles and not really experiencing a story interwoven between them. But
well,
I think that was quite a while. It was on the regular DS, so it was quite a while ago.
Okay. I liked it enough that I actually picked up the Professor Layton versus Phoenix Wright.
Oh boy, look at this guy.
But I haven't played it yet. So
I actually, speaking of Phoenix Wright, I've never played a Phoenix Wright game, and I was like, what's with this game? So I started watching a YouTube Let's Play of Duel something. It's like one of the newer Phoenix Wright games.
Okay.
And literally I watched, well, some fast forwarding in between, but I watched probably an hour and I couldn't tell. I don't think the guy pressed a single button except well, to skip the talking.
I have the, they released some of the Phoenix Wright games for iOS
or oh, really?
Maybe all of them. I don't remember exactly what it is, but they had a pretty good deal on it where it was like $5 and you had like a bunch of the games and I played a bit of it. And I don't know. It had potential, but I really, it's a lot of reading just text. And I don't know. I mean, that's.
It seemed like it. It seemed like it was reading a court case, and then occasionally you get to select the piece of evidence.
Yeah.
And then it explains more of the court case. I don't know. It didn't seem like it was going to be for me from watching that video.
Yeah. And I kind of like, I've always wanted to try the Phoenix Wright games as well. But I don't know. I was hoping the combination of the two might be something good, but I can't speak to that yet. I'll get to it eventually. A couple other things. Rollers of the Realm, have you played it?
Yes, I have, actually. I was gonna save it for next show, but
yeah, we'll probably talk about it a little bit more with Frank, but obviously some friends of ours and some ex Silicon Knights employees made this game. It's a pinball RPG and
also published by Atlas.
And I'm really enjoying it. I mean, the thing that I was surprised about is how kind of literal they were able to take the mechanics of pinball and put it into like an RPG, action RPG kind of
space. Yeah, it maps really well.
Because like I was thinking to myself, well, okay, it's still going to be pinball. It's just, you know, you level up or something. But it's literally like you're using the paddle to hit the ball into enemies to kill enemies and stuff like that.
And the balls are essentially your RPG, what do they call them? Not
your
character types.
Party members.
Yeah, but they're like archetypes.
Classes.
So each ball has their own special ability, a healer, rogue, warrior who does more damage to guys. So, and you can swap these balls in and out as long as they haven't died, aka fallen down into the return box or whatever you call it on the pinball machine.
Yeah.
And I think they did a really good job of balancing that sort of aspect. Also having little puzzle elements in each level.
Right.
You know, finding this hidden treasure chest, getting the key to open this, finding whatever. I think, I don't know. I haven't beaten it, but I've enjoyed everything I've played of it so far.
Yeah, so recommend that. And
that's on PC, PS4, and Vita.
Right. Quick iOS thing to mention. I haven't played a ton of this, but it's kind of a unique thing that I think is worth mentioning. There's a game out for, I don't know if it's for Android as well yet, but for iOS called Mayday Deep Space. And the game is written and I think designed by Daniel Wilson, I believe his name is. He's the guy who did the book Robopocalypse, which was supposed to be made into a movie, was directed by Spielberg, hasn't happened yet. Anyway, he's kind of a known sci-fi author. But the thing with this game is you basically are taking control of somebody who's like kind of stranded on this spaceship via voice command. So that's the whole thing, is you're telling them, okay, move forward, go left, wait, stop, move forward, run faster. And you're talking to your phone, telling these voice commands. Do you?
Yes, I do.
Why?
Because it reminds you of old text adventure games you used to play on the Commodore 64.
Well, not exactly. Although I was going to mention that it
Go east again.
it kind of dovetails with an idea I had for something, which I'll get to in a minute. But the thing is, I mean, it's not entirely practical for a mobile game because, I mean, I'm not going to play this on the GO train. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
Just sitting there talking.
Wait.
Yeah.
Make sure you're not in the quiet zone.
So that's kind of funny. But the interesting thing is, like, for the most part, you're kind of looking at a map and you're trying to direct somebody and you're not actually able to see what's going on, but the voice acting is telling you what this guy is seeing.
Oh, I see.
And the voice acting is actually really good. So I found that was kind of compelling how it was painting this picture of what's going on. But the idea I had for a game that I thought would be cool is kind of what you're talking about. The idea of, I was thinking, like, you know, you can listen to audiobooks if you're, you know, you're in your car, you're commuting somewhere.
Yep.
Right? So you can listen to audiobooks. What if you had an interactive audiobook where you could, like, literally...
Like a choose-your-own-adventure
audiobook. Choose-your-own-adventure or, like, a text adventure where you get a bit of the story and then you say, okay, open that drawer, do this, do that, and you give voice commands. But, you know, you're in your car, so you're not, you don't look like a crazy person. Well, you might, but nobody can hear you.
That's actually a great idea.
And I think that would be really cool. I just, I didn't
license
necessarily
it.
Know, like, now that I know that there is, like, because I think this is using Siri or using some of the, some underlying iOS thing that's there. Yeah, I think there's some potential here for some interesting stuff, so.
That's actually a really good idea. I bet people are looking for that kind of thing on their commute.
I better cut it out.
Yeah, you better cut it. Cut it.
We always give away all our great ideas on this show.
Yeah.
And last but not least, I don't have a mind fuck of the month.
What?
But since Frank's not here to get mad at me for using this term, I'm going to give you my Metroidvania of the month.
There we go.
I've actually got two because I played Shantae and the Pirate's Curse.
I've heard of it.
Which is the third in this series. It's kind of like a...
I think this is a Kickstarter game.
I think you're right. Or maybe... I know there's a sequel that they're working on, too.
I don't know
if that one was kickstarted. But so, yeah. So it's kind of like an action-adventure platformer. But I had played the previous installment in this series, and just for some reason, it never grabbed me. But, you know, I kept hearing everybody say that this has, you know, the Metroid kind of design template. And, yeah, it does. And I'm really enjoying it, actually.
That's interesting you say that, because... I've heard of this game, but I thought it was just a side-scrolling action game. I didn't realize it was sort of like Metroidvania style. So
I mean, this,
that interests me a lot more that way.
This particular one, I mean, it's kind of... It's hard to explain, because essentially there's different islands you go to. And so you go to an island and you complete some stuff, and then you get an item, and then you can come back to the main island. So things are kind of separated a little bit more than you would think in one of these kind of games, but it's the same
concept
idea.
Yeah.
And so the other one that I played a bit of, which is available now for the 3DS, is Zeo Drifter.
I've heard of this game, but I know nothing about it.
Yeah, so this is made by Renegade Kid, is that the company name? The people who did Mutant Muds.
I know that game as well, but it doesn't ring a bell.
And this is a lot more straight up Metroid clone, kind of like, it's, you know, takes place in space essentially, and it's much more like a pixel art. I don't know if it's 8-bit, but you know, the graphics are definitely more retro style and all that kind of thing. But I found it a little bit frustrating, like, it, because there's four worlds you can kind of go to initially. And like some of those worlds, you start the level and it's like you die immediately. And then you slowly realize, okay, wait a minute, maybe I don't have what I need for this level. I'll go try one of the other ones.
Yeah.
And it's like you keep kind of...
like Mega Man in that regard?
I guess a little bit, yeah. But I found like I was ping-ponging back and forth between all of them, and I'd get a little bit further and maybe get one item or one power-up, and then I'd go back to the other one, and it would still be really hard. So I found it, maybe just the difficulty level was just a little too much for me. But I don't know, maybe I missed something. I was playing it before Christmas and I haven't really gone back to it yet, but I probably will.
I just remembered I have a Metroidvania game I can add to your list here.
What do you got?
I played a little bit of Strider.
Nice.
Have you played that on PS4?
I have played a bit of it, yeah.
That game, when I started playing it, I was enjoying it, and I thought for sure it was made by the same guys that made Shadow Complex.
Right, yeah.
And it wasn't. It was made by a different company, but it looks and feels almost exactly the same.
Yeah, the kind of 2.5D kind of thing, right?
So I don't know if they used Unreal Engine as well, but they probably did, because it's proven to work in this kind of environment. But I was really enjoying it. I didn't play that much. I got kind of swamped by a whole slew of library games that came in all at once. But I was enjoying that game. I'll probably go back to it now that I've played most of the new PS4 games.
Yeah, I think if there was a Vita version, I would have probably played it all the way through by now, but I've only played a bit. Was it free? I think that was free for Plus,
it was,
right?
Yeah, that's how I got it. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
I've been going through my PS4 PlayStation Plus backlog that I was never able to play because I didn't have a PS4. So
right.
Playing a bunch of stuff on there.
Cool. All right, well, I think that's it for me.
That's it for me.
All right, well, no junk mail because we didn't even ask for it this time.
It's a pretty long show regardless.
Yeah, so we will try to get a regular show, and if it's not completely irrelevant by the time we record, maybe do a best of 2014.
Most anticipated of the last 11 to 10 months of 2015.
Yeah. So I'll run down some quick upcoming releases. Obviously, Citizens of Earth, January 20th, along with Resident Evil Remastered. And then Dying Light on January 27th and Grim Fandango Remastered, which I am actually looking forward to. Yeah,
of course you are.
I mean, that's I never really played much of it. I remember because it came out in that era when like I didn't really have a good PC to play play it on. And I don't, was that ever out for like PlayStation or anything?
I don't
like
think
that?
So. I think it was a PC exclusive.
Yeah. So for whatever reason, yeah, I just never really played it, but really want to. Evolve is on February 10th. That's the new game from the guys who did Left 4 Dead, I believe. Sort of like a co-op.
I know the game. I don't know who does it, though. There's like a monster and then four hunters. It's yeah. Kind of like a co-op monster hunt game.
Yeah, so looking forward to that. February 13th, Legend of Zelda Majora's Mask, along with Monster Hunter 4 Ultimate. Throughout February and March, there's the Resident Evil Revelations 2 release, which is split up into three episodes. Kirby and the Rainbow Curse, February 20th. The Order 1886, also February 20th.
That game's kind of scaring me now. It seems like they're not releasing much details.
Well, I was just really surprised that that's seems really soon, and I haven't really been hearing a ton about it
now. Yeah, that's what I mean. That's what's scaring me.
I'm wondering if it's going to get delayed again.
Maybe. They had that like really good E3 werewolf trailer thing.
Yeah.
And then they had the latest trailer at, I think it was the PlayStation Experience, which showed something completely different in like an airship. And when that trailer came out, I didn't know what that game was about anymore and what kind of they were going for. So it will be interesting to see what starts to come out about that game as we get closer to its release.
Yeah. I mean, it's the next big PS4 game, really, so.
It's advertised all over the PSN store.
Yeah.
So.
A couple other things coming out. Mario vs. Donkey Kong Tipping Stars on March 5th. Mario Party 10, March 20th. Bloodborne, March 24th, which is the new game from the guys who did Dark Souls, I believe.
Yes, or maybe Demon Souls. One of the guys kind of split off. Oh, no, it was Dark Souls, the first one.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then Mortal Kombat 10, April 14th. The Witcher 3, May 19th. And Batman Arkham Knight, June 2nd.
I think Witcher 3 may have got pushed. Oh, no, maybe that is the push date.
I think that's the new date.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, it's weird. That's pretty much it in terms of...
Seems light.
Release dates that are set. There's obviously lots of other big games coming out sometime this year, but
Where is anything Microsoft exclusive in there? Pretty sparse,
but I mean, I don't know. They had a few exclusives for the holidays at least. I'm not sure what else they have on the horizon. I know there's some good indie games that I'm really waiting to find out when they're coming out, so... Anyway, thanks everyone for listening, and obviously you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/gamejunkpodcast, or Facebook, facebook.com/gamejunk, and we post news every now and then.
And now YouTube, youtube.com/gamejunk.
That's right. So we're going to be doing more of these Twitch live streams, hopefully.
Yeah, I did one for the Banner Saga a couple nights ago.
Cool. So keep an eye out for info on that. I guess, where can we follow...
Plug Ryan?
Yeah.
Ryan is at Eden Industries on Twitter. Eden Industries' website is edenindustries.ca. We have the Facebook game for Citizens of Earth, facebook.com/citizensofearthgame, atlas.com/citizensofearth. That probably does it, actually. That's probably everywhere he is. Oh, we also have a Citizens of Earth Twitter handle. It's COE Game, or at COE Game.
Nice. But,
I think that's it, and everyone should look for that game on the 20th and take advantage of that discount.
Okay. And you can follow us individually on Twitter, My Angry Commute and Film Junk. And obviously, Frank is Dirty Frank with 3 Hours and Dirty.
Bye, and Frank. We missed you.
Until next time, we'll see you guys later. Bye-bye.
Later.